Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, today's feature presentation, Driving Miss Daisy.
No, man. No.
Just what I'm talking about. It's turn to the dim. I'm out of here, man.
Hey, yo, check it out, man. I got Black C's at the crib, man. Y'all want to go check that out?
Yeah. That's the idea. We could have rolled it from the beginning, y'all.
Fuck Hollywood.
Let's go to Hollywood now, where there's always been a question of who gets to tell your story.
I think when we are talking about African-American film history, it is a complex one that oftentimes really looks at a very kind of flat, one-dimensional understanding of storytelling of people and has historically been riddled with stereotypes and pejorative images.
That's Rhea Combs. She's the curator of film and photography at the National Museum of African American History. And this week marks the start of the museum's first ever African American Film Festival. And Combs says the films being shown push back against harmful Hollywood tropes.
There has been a very rich tradition of image makers, black image makers in particular, who have fought against that tide, have pushed fervently to showcase very complex and complicated stories. So we want to be able to celebrate and recognize the fact that there have been those undertold stories that have been produced and being made for decades.
Many of the films in the festival's lineup are from the 1960s and 70s, an era when activists were starting to recognize the power of film.
You had people speaking out against injustice, and they were picking up a camera. And so it's really exciting that we're able to show work like this one piece called Malcolm X Struggle for Freedom that hasn't been screened in the last 30 to 40 years. And we restored this film that looks at Malcolm X in Paris 3 months before he was assassinated.
The restoration process that Combs mentions there is at the center of the museum's overall mission when it comes to African-American cinema. Cane River, a 1982 film directed by Horace Jenkins, is among those that are being featured after being restored.
I'd like a one-way ticket to Cane River, please.
Cane River? I don't believe I've heard of Cane River.
Well, Natchitoches, I'll get him to drop me off on the way up.
Natchitoches? Sure, that'll be $16.75.
Jenkins was an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker, and Cane River was his first feature-length narrative film. Just months after the film premiered in New Orleans, the 42-year-old director died of a heart attack, and Cane River never received distribution.
After my father died, that was it. Flash forward to a couple of years ago, and I found an article in the New York Times about an organization called Indie Collect, and they had found his film. And they were looking to restore it. So I reached out to them and I said, hey, I'm Sasha Jenkins. Horace is my dad and I'm a filmmaker too. What's up? And met with the Indie Collect people and they've been really amazing. And then, you know, some years later, here we are.
That's Sasha Jenkins, Horace's son, who was only around 10 when his father died. This week, after a years-long restoration process, the film is finally being screened again to the public at the African American Film Festival. Watching the restored film for the first time, Jenkins says it feels distinct, even by today's standards.
The simple way to describe it is a love story. You know, a young man who is of Creole descent falls in love with a African-American woman who is of a darker shade. So it deals with color and class, you know, he being from a privileged family, The legend was his ancestors owned slaves.
Your great-grandmother owned the Melrose Plantation, right?
As the story goes, that's true, but that's about all the story I know.
An African woman who owned slaves.
Oh, no. She owned slaves? No, she didn't own no slaves. She was a slave herself.
What my father was able to illustrate in the film is there are so many nuances in terms of race in America then and now. The conversation amongst black people about black people is an important part of the film. And just a gentle sort of love story involving black people in a way that you've never really seen it before. Particularly during that era, the blaxploitation era, or coming out of that era, everything was just very aggressive and over the top. And his take on romance was very sensual and sensitive and very loving. And it's unfortunate that it didn't see the light of day when it did. Who knows what it would have meant or how things could have changed or what kind of influence it could have had. But I think people who get to see the film now will have an appreciation for all the things that he was trying to say.
Now, I can't speak for everybody on Cane River, but that's how it was in my family.
Well, what about those people that didn't make it? What about them?
Maria, we treated everybody equally. Everybody.
You know, my mama made me promise I'd never see you again.
What? Well, that's just about the dumbest. As a matter of fact, that's about the dumbest thing I ever heard of. They don't want me to see you because of something that happened 200 years ago.
That's the film's protagonist, Peter, who returns home to fight for his land in Louisiana as he tries to court his love interest, Maria. When I sat down with Sasha, he told me why the film still resonates with viewers in 2018.
Land ownership is an important part of the story. And there was a statistic that someone in the film said that, like, every week, black folks are losing 1,000 acres of land. And by the year XYZ, black people won't have anything. And I thought that was a really powerful idea, the sense, this idea of ownership and land ownership and the relationship that cultures have to the land. And as people who are of African and Native descent, having this relationship and rapport with the land and this ownership of the land in this, you know, sort of European system of what it means to own land. Well, we're here. So if we're going to participate, we might as well be owners as well. That was an important sort of subplot in the story that when you mix that in with feminism, colorism, class, there's a lot there.
Did you learn anything about your dad that you didn't know or didn't have a sense of through this film?
Well, you know, my parents split when I was young and he moved on to another relationship. The woman that he was in a relationship with before he died, she's from the region and she, you know, worked on the film and had a hand in sort of cluing him into the world and why it's interesting and important. But inside of the romance in the film, I had a sense of what it might have been like for my parents, you know, what that courtship might have been like, because it was, there's something very, I don't want to say simple, but something so tender about the way the characters interact that it's very genuine. You can't really, you can't make that up. It would be super corny. You know, I mean, someone said recently who saw the film that it has a very 80s vibe.
What does that mean?
Well,
I was a kid in the 80s, so what does that mean?
Well, if you're a kid from the 80s, you will love the appearance of designer jeans. Everyone's rocking designer jeans. Everyone's butt, male and female, looks great. There's a photo mat, you know, I don't know, for those who are old enough to remember.
You mean the days we used to have to take film
right,
and actually get it developed, right?
At a little hut that was usually stationed in a parking lot. There was a photo mat. You know, so the pacing, you know, there's an 80s pacing, maybe. Like if you watch 60 Minutes from 1975, it's like, it's really hard. You know, it's really slow, the pacing. Everything's so quick now. But I think the pacing of the film is in the spirit of the story he wanted to tell. He was a documentary filmmaker. So there are long scenes. Music is a very important part of the film. And it was funny, the editor was telling a story of how my father would make everyone listen to the soundtrack, and he made me listen to it too. That's the one thing that I always remembered. But in some instances, the music plays out in a way that it's almost like a music video, which to me, like almost like a long form music video, which in an interesting way was kind of ahead of its time, or sort of merging with the emergence of music videos. And I learned from someone that he was inspired by Superfly, for instance, that had like a amazing soundtrack, and he wanted the soundtrack to almost be a character in the film, and that's definitely the way it is.
Do you think that when you look at black film today in 2018, do you think that there is enough nuance of black everyday life in those films, similar to the way that your dad was able to bring that to life? Because I think that is one of the most compelling things that you're talking about, is just how nuanced and how delicate these portrayals were. Do you see that filmmakers are getting better at that?
Well, I think Hollywood is recognizing that there's money in this audience and people of color have more than one way to be. And there's nothing wrong with not having a broad worldview, but Hollywood television in particular likes to put people in boxes. Why? Marketing, money. Okay, this very specific group of black people like these hair care products so you can sell stuff to people. I get it, but I think this sort of box, that same, you know, pun intended, black box that we've often been put in, it's too small. It doesn't fit anymore. And you look at, you know, my man Childish Gambino, you know, you look at this sort of new wave of, okay, here are some other black people, too, who have stories to tell who are great. And so I have hope that things are changing. But, you know, change never comes as quickly as you'd like.
You're also a filmmaker. Are there any projects that you're working on coming up?
Working on a 4-part film about the Wu-Tang Clan. It's their 25th anniversary this year. And to really understand Wu-Tang Clan, I mean, you can listen to their music and enjoy it. It sounds great. But, like, to really peel back the lyrics is to have a real understanding of who they are and where they come from. And as I tell people all the time, to understand hip hop or blues or jazz, you know, all of these art forms are a reflection of and a reaction to the environment. And so to tell the Wu-Tang story, you've got to understand the environment, all the things that they went through to become who they are. And so to me, the music is the cherry on top. It's all the other stuff, the environment, the social climate, all the things that they had to overcome that really make their story compelling.
Is there anything that you're taking away from your dad's filmmaking process and incorporating it into the work that you do?
Well, saying something. Every time I have the opportunity to make a film, I say something. You know, I did a film called Fresh Dressed about the history of hip-hop fashion, and you learn about Sunday Best, and most people, you say Sunday Best, and they think it means wear a nice suit, but they don't realize it means that in certain states, it was mandated that they had to buy their slaves a nice outfit so they can go to church and worship a God that's white, or supposedly white. There aren't a lot of people who look like me who have the opportunity to say things, and so I like to entertain people, but I think it's also important to say something. So every film I do, and my father would definitely feel very strongly about that.
Sasha Jenkins is a writer and filmmaker. Sasha, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sorry, so sorry.
Megyn Kelly and her NBC Morning talk show may soon be off the air. Kelly was hired away from Fox News in 2017 with much fanfare and a big paycheck. Yet her time at the network has seen some controversy, including comments she made about blackface just this week. Yesterday, an emotional Kelly apologized.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the show. I'm Megyn Kelly, and I want to begin with two words. I'm sorry.
Now, NPR's David Folkenflik is reporting her employment by NBC appears to be over. David joins us from our studios in New York City. Hey there, David.
Hey, Audie.
So describe exactly what Kelly said that caused this latest controversy.
Well, Kelly, obviously, as host of the 9 a.m. hour of the Today Show, was having a chat a couple days ago with several panelists about Halloween and costumes, and talks about how she's not PC, and then started to talk about what it was to dress up as somebody of a different race. Here's what she had to say.
What is racist? Because truly, you do get in trouble if you are a white person who puts on blackface for Halloween, or a black person who puts on whiteface for Halloween. Like, when I was a kid, that was okay as long as you were dressing up as like a character.
And that, of course, tapping into a rich vein of pain in terms of the course of American history, depiction of African Americans by whites.
How did her fellow NBC colleagues react to all this?
pretty sharply. It was notable in two ways, one of which was the significant coverage that was given to the story, both by on the NBC Nightly News. Obviously, it's anchored by Lester Holt, the only African-American anchor among the big three broadcast American networks, and also on Today Show in the hours preceding her own show. Two of her African-American colleagues really weighed in. First, let's hear from Al Roker. He noted that she had apologized to colleagues but said she needed to do more.
She owes a bigger apology to folks of color around the country, because this is a history going back to the 1830s. Minstrel shows to mean and denigrate a race wasn't right.
And then also Craig Melvin, perhaps the newest co-host at Today Show, he weighed in as well.
There was some criticism yesterday online that this was political correctness run amok. That's silly, and it's disingenuous, and it's just as ignorant and racist as the statement itself.
NBC News Chairman Andy Lack, at a meeting with staffers this week on the subject, refused to defend her as well.
This isn't the first time Megyn Kelly has faced criticism while at NBC. Why do people think this was the last straw?
Well, I think there are a couple things going on. First off, it tapped in as well to her own history in terms of remarks on race from her days as a Fox News host, a much sharper-edged Fox News host. She had insisted that both Santa Claus and Jesus Christ were white. Back in 2013, she said she regretted that last year once she was at NBC. But also, her show has been ailing. It's had rather tepid ratings, and she had her relationship had cooled with executives as she had really embraced at times the Me Too movement, including accusations of sexual harassment against some of NBC's biggest stars, not only Matt Lauer, who was fired, but the former NBC News anchor Tom Brokaw, much beloved figure who retains his ties to the network.
What have you learned about what's next for her?
I want to be very clear about this. A source with direct knowledge of the matter says it's clear she won't be returning. It seems impossible to imagine, but these things aren't quite concrete yet. You know, Andrew Lack has been her biggest champion, despite the fact that she had a fairly cool and conflicted reaction and welcome from employees at NBC. She displaced a couple of popular figures in Tamara Hall and Al Roker at that 9 a.m. hour, and her ratings didn't do a heck of a lot for it. In addition, she was paid an extraordinary amount of money for the thing, and she really took on a lot of fire as a figure who brought on ideological baggage, who brought Fox News baggage, and it turned out didn't bring a whole lot of success at the box office.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Thank you.
You bet.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
Historically, rates of breast cancer in Black women had been lower than that of white women, though the trend has changed somewhat and the rates now are about the same. But what hasn't changed is the higher mortality rate among African American women. According to the American Cancer Society, Black women are about 40% more likely to die from breast cancer than white women. Some of the reasons for this include late detection and lack of proper health care, but a recent study provides some additional clues. Researchers at the University of North Carolina Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center launched the study. It was led by Stephanie Wheeler, a professor of health policy and management at UNC Chapel Hill, and she joins us now. Stephanie, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Give us an overview of your research and what you found.
Sure. So this was funding from the American Cancer Society to support this work. And we surveyed women who were part of the Carolina Breast Cancer Study cohort, which is a large prospective study of women throughout North Carolina from 44 different counties. And the study was really interested in understanding access to care and survivorship issues for women with breast cancer. And what was really unique about the study is that we over-recruited African-American women and women younger than 50. Both of those groups are typically underrepresented in most other studies. So it was a unique opportunity to look at treatment differences in these two populations.
And what'd you find?
Yeah, so really interesting results. So first and foremost, when we looked at endocrine therapy adherence, which endocrine therapies are recommended for women who have hormone receptor positive disease, this is a therapy that should be taken for 5 to 10 years and is associated with huge reductions in recurrence risk. We found that at 2 years post-diagnosis, so not even halfway through the full duration of therapy, 1 in 4 Black women were not taking the medication as prescribed, compared to 16% of white women. So a very large racial difference in adherence to this life-saving medication. And in addition to that, we looked at a lot of different reasons for non-adherence, everything from side effects, to cost, to their beliefs about the benefit of endocrine therapy. And across the board, Black women were reporting all of these as barriers to their adherence.
So let's break them down. Let's talk about, let's start with cost, I suppose, and let's start there.
Mm-hmm. With respect to cost, cost was one of the lower predictors mm-hmm. of overall non-adherence. When we asked women about whether they were not taking the pills due to cost, approximately 17% of Black women were saying that that was a concern for them versus about 7% of white women. So this is, again, you know, not super common, but a right. concern for a lot of these women.
So what was the biggest reason?
So the biggest reason was actually ambivalence about the benefit of the therapy. When we talk about the side effects and the burden of taking a medication every day for up to 10 years versus what they perceive the risk reduction to be in terms of recurrence, most of the women who were non-adherent were more often saying that they didn't see the benefit or they didn't understand the benefit. And at the end of the day, it wasn't worth it to them.
Yeah, I would think compliance would be low. Any therapy that has to be taken daily for 10 years, I would think at some point there's a big drop-off. But you're saying right. there is a difference now.
Right, absolutely. And again, this is a therapy that a lot of my medical oncology friends stress is more important even than your chemotherapy. So it is a drug that works. It's wildly successful. And in the grand scheme of things, doesn't cost a lot of money. So if we can help women understand the true benefits and really support them as they're coping with this daily expectation, then that can be really beneficial.
There are other costs as well, though, and those are the side effects. And talk
right.
about the impact they may have had.
Yeah, so this is a really important issue. So this is a medication that, depending on whether you're taking tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitors, it's associated with a lot of side effects. So hot flashes, night sweats, joint pain if you're on aromatase inhibitors. And all of these side effects were very common in this patient population, as we would expect. What's interesting is when we control for factors like your belief in the medication's efficacy and the extent to which you experienced a shared decision-making process with your provider, when we control for those things, actually side effects is not predictive of non-adherence.
Among white women and Black women?
That's right. And so we attribute this to a concept called resilience. And so we actually have done some qualitative work interviewing both Black and white women who are taking this medication. And they talk about this. They talk about adaptive strategies and coping mechanisms that they use. Very creative coping mechanisms in some cases, walking around with fans and water bottles and, you know, walking in general can make a big difference for joint pain. So contrary to popular belief, side effects are very burdensome and they do affect women's quality of life. But at least in our study, they don't seem to be the predominant factor that's leading to non-adherence.
So the key is, and whether or not you're going to apply all of these good tricks for becoming resilient and dealing with it, has to do with whether you think it's worth it, whether
Absolutely.
It's going to actually do any good. And you've been very clear about this in everything that you've said and written, that this is not about blaming the victim.
Right.
So what do we do about this?
I think that some of the opportunities here are really working with women to support them in understanding their personal and specific barriers. So for some women, it may be cost. For other women, it may be, you know, just this problem with not really believing or not understanding the risk reduction. For others, it's just the logistical issues of getting the medication refilled promptly and remembering to take it on a day-to-day basis. So because there's this multitude of factors that are differentially experienced by different women, we need strategies and interventions that can meet women where they are. And they need to be culturally competent. One of the things that we're looking at is the potential for motivational interviewing counseling to work individually with women to understand what their goals are of treatment, and then to try to help them problem solve and find solutions that work for them.
Well, you talk about the importance of working one woman at a time with this, and yet we have seen a culturally, statistically significant difference along racial lines. So let's talk a little bit more about that, and I want to bring into the conversation now Dr. Doris Brown, a medical oncologist and former president of the National Medical Association, recently retired from the National Cancer Institute, where she managed breast cancer programs. Dr. Brown, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
What do you make of these findings? Were you surprised by the findings in this study?
Not really. Again, knowing about the Carolina breast cancer cohort and the participation of looking at the large group of African-American women in the study, again, no, it was not surprising. I think we know from African Americans participating in clinical trials, the numbers have been very low, but because there was an oversampling in this particular study, the area that I think was really very important is that these women did not want to stop taking therapy. They did understand that this had some benefit, but I think the duration of the therapy has always been of concern, particularly when you talk about taking a medication for 5 to 10 years. And as Dr. Wheeler has spoken about, in terms of looking at some of the, say, taking out the side effects and comparing that to the two groups, that there were some resiliency issues that would come into effect. I think the other real issue is having those women have a closer relationship with the healthcare providers that's giving them the therapy, and that there perhaps should be some greater concordance. And again, I don't know whether that was looked at in the study, whether the provider and the patient were of the same racial and ethnic group in convincing those patients that it was important to maintain the duration of taking that therapy, in addition to recognizing the side effects and the importance of those side effects. And I think the one issue that I have seen in patients that have to take medications for a long period of time is that you really have to have a shared responsibility of getting them to understand, because many times African-American women, because they did not participate in the original study to get that drug to market, the side effects that they may be speaking about may be considered less important and not one of the four or five major ones. And so when they say, well, I have some muscle aching, well, that's not one of the top five or 10 side effects. And so perhaps it is not of that great significance, and they discard that. The provider may discard it. Or maybe when they are talking with the patient, not really connecting in a communicative way to really have them know that you're sharing in this responsibility, and so you're getting some muscle ache. So let's kind of work to see how we can lower that. And maybe it is related to that, but it may be related to something else that you're taking, or the combination of things. Because I think when we look at African-American women or African-American patients, many of them come in with other conditions. So they may have one or two other chronic diseases that they're taking medications for, and we need to look at in a study the combination of the chemotherapeutic agent or the endocrine therapy combined with the other medications that they're taking, and does that have an impact on the therapy that they're taking? And we haven't really looked at that.
Stephanie Wheeler, that's the next part of your study, right? Figuring out ways to implement some of these changes.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we just finished a pilot study at UNC Lineberger where we recruited racially diverse women to participate in a motivational interviewing intervention study. Right. And colleagues of ours at Ohio State University at the same time were testing a text message reminder intervention study to help women with the daily issues that some face around remembering to take medication. Both studies were very successful in the pilot stage, and we've just finished writing a grant recently to combine the interventions and look at the potential benefit of having different mediators of the adherence process being targeted. So remembering, and then also the motivational interviewing, really getting at problem solving for women.
I want to thank you both for being on the program. Stephanie Wheeler is lead author of the study launched by the University of North Carolina Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. She's also a professor of health policy and management at UNC Chapel Hill. Dr. Doris Brown is a medical oncologist and former president of the Black Physicians Group and the National Medical Association, and retired from the National Cancer Institute. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Man, this shit worse than cancer, like a fucking disease. Living a nightmare, they telling this dream. Look what they did to Martin Luther, bullet holes in our kings. And they wonder why we never believe. And they wonder why we never will leave. Nigga, we poor. Young niggas worried about that corner store, but the chinks on that. And you claiming that's your block, who you think on that? Quicksand in the hood and we gonna sink on that. You should think on that. Poison water out in Flint, they let them little babies drink on that. They don't care about us.
Monday night, in the city of Flint, people pulled up in their cars to the Asbury United Methodist Church. They slept in a long line of vehicles, hoping to be near the front when volunteers started handing out pallets of bottled water at 10 a.m. Tuesday morning.
The line was like 7 or 8 blocks. We have about 400 to 600 people to come through the lines.
Kalika Lewis-Harris goes by Miss K. She coordinates this help center. It's one of three that pop up in the city on different days of the week.
Thank you. We're good.
In 2014, the state switched Flint's water supply in an effort to save money. Water from the Flint River came out of people's taps looking brown and smelling like sewage. Government leaders at all levels told people the water was safe. It wasn't. The improperly treated water corroded old pipes that leached lead into faucets and showers. Kids were poisoned with lead. The state provided free bottled water for 2 years until April. And now, after switching back to the original water supply, the state once again says the tap water is safe to drink. Companies and charities donated these pallets of bottled water. Ms. Kay says there isn't enough for everybody who lines up to get some.
I'm really discouraged because this is ongoing for years and years and years. I have people that cry, and it's just upsetting.
Do you still live in Flint? Do you use the water?
I still live in Flint. I do. I use the water not to drink, but to bathe.
So when you're cooking, when you're brushing your teeth, you're still opening bottles of water?
Yes, sir.
And have been doing it for years?
Yes.
Does it just feel routine now, or does it still feel like I can't believe I'm doing this?
Both.
And when the government says, look, we've done the tests, there's safe levels of lead, it's okay, you just don't believe it?
I do not believe it. The trust is gone. The trust is gone for everybody.
Flint's mayor supports her view, arguing that the water won't be safe until all of Flint's corroded lead pipes have been replaced and the medical community signs off on it. Until that happens, people are still lining up to get water wherever they can.
I guess it's something you have to live with for now, you know, to come out every week and get water, you know.
Larkin Mowackle is 72, inching forward in his car.
I used to get my water delivered because I was a senior. They used to bring my water to me at my house, you know.
It's heavy work lifting all those cases of water.
Well, when they were delivering, they'll bring it right inside for me.
But not anymore.
No. This year when I get home, I got to take it out myself, you know.
Flint, Michigan is one of the poorest cities in the country. More than 40% of people here live below the poverty line. It's also more than 50% black. At this church, Pastor Rigel Dawson says the poisoned water was just the latest setback.
The water crisis was one more thing on top of a whole lot that this community's had to deal with, the disinvestment, the jobs going away. And so this was like almost the straw that broke the camel's back, you know, in a lot of ways. But we're resilient. You know, the people here are strong, and we keep moving forward.
Some of the workers digging up the median here are wearing bright yellow vests that say City of Flint Fast Start with an image of a wrench and a faucet. They've been at this for years, and they are nowhere near close to replacing all of the pipes that need to be dug out.
Right now, I think we're either 75% complete on SLRs, the service line replacements.
Jeff Grayer is project manager for W.T. Stevens Construction, one of the companies the city has contracted to dig up the pipes. But when he says they're 75% done, he's only talking about the service lines between the house and the street. He's not including pipes in people's houses or the water mains under the road.
There's still quite a bit left to do, yes.
And in terms of when you can totally close the book and say mission accomplished?
Yeah, good question. We are hoping within a couple of years, mission will be accomplished.
Did you grow up in Flint? Or is
yes,
this, a place?
This is home for me.
This is home for you?
This is home. I grew up here.
How personal is this job for you?
Very personal. I grew up on the North End, and my entire family lives here in Flint.
Does your family have tough conversations where they yell at you, why isn't your crew at our house yet?
All the time.
The city says they're ahead of schedule on pipe replacement. The state of Michigan sent us a written statement saying Flint's water has tested safe for more than 2 years. In the Michigan governor's race, both candidates have talked about Flint on the campaign trail. Everybody we talked to in the city rolled their eyes at that.
It's a great soundbite. Let's see what happens after November 6th.
This is Janaea McDonald. I first met her almost 3 years ago when Flint was making national headlines for the water crisis. We've been checking in with her regularly as she and her husband raise two boys in the city. Today, they use bottled water that they buy to cook and brush their teeth. They use filters on the shower to bathe. When I went to their house this week, it was the first time I'd heard Janaea express a little bit of hope. Her older son, Justice, had a skin condition the last time we were here.
His eczema, his flare-ups are not as frequent, and when they do come, they're not as bad as they used to be.
I remember when we were here the first time, you said you were known for your long hair.
Yeah.
And it started coming out when you bathed in the water.
Yes.
And it's growing longer now.
It has. It's almost to my shoulders now.
Justice was 6 when we first met him. Now at age 9, he's smart and curious. He listens carefully to our interview with his mother and then jumps in.
And also, I have a question.
What's your question?
Why does the pipes break in Flint and in the others that they don't?
Well, it wasn't that our pipes broke in Flint. What happened was...
She goes into a long, fact-based explanation about the state government's decision to change water sources in an effort to save money. And later, when we're alone, she says that question from her son really threw her.
It's his first time asking me that ever. And that kind of... that was a lot.
Is it hard to know what to say?
It is. It is. And especially trying to contain my emotions because I don't, you know, just want to break down in front of them because they're not understanding why is she so upset.
What's the answer that you would have given to that question if it had not been asked by one of your children?
I probably, honestly, I feel like it was done on purpose because Flint is predominantly Black, and who cares? I feel like it's pretty much where the nation is right now. You see young Black boys getting murdered by white police officers all across the nation. So what do I think as a Black mother raising Black boys? How do I think a government that's predominantly white, how do they show me what they feel about me and us here in Flint? They showed us. Everyone want to say racism is not alive. It is so alive and it's so sad. And I, you know, it's hard not to teach your kids about it without sounding racist. You know what I mean? I don't want my children to hate anyone because of the color of their skin. I want to be careful when I'm answering things for him because I want him to be an adult that's able to change the world.
On one level, this story in Flint is about water. But on another level, it's about trust in government, feeling like your voice matters and that elected leaders care about you. Pipes are hard to fix. Those other things are even harder.
It's the nation's capital, it's Washington, D.C. It's the nation's capital, it's the nation's capital, it's the nation's capital, it's Washington, D.C.
An effort to get guns off the streets of Washington, D.C. has not been working as intended. Police have seized thousands of firearms, but in other ways the effort has failed, and this is a story of the side effects. More than one-third of suspects arrested on gun possession charges in Washington ultimately walk free, and residents in heavily patrolled neighborhoods are left feeling racially profiled. WAMU's Patrick Madden reports.
On the streets of D.C., residents call them jump outs. You're walking down the street. An unmarked cop car rolls up. Police officers get out and start asking questions. Can you lift up your shirt? Can we pat you down?
It's normal in my neighborhood for the police to stop and frisk. On this particular day, it was my turn.
39-year-old MB Cottingham was hanging outside his aunt's house in Southwest D.C. last year when several officers showed up.
Do we have any guns? That's the first thing they say.
A cell phone video of this interaction last year has gone viral. It shows an officer repeatedly patting down Cottingham in his crotch area. Police didn't find a gun.
It's not easy to just hand over your manhood like that. It's not easy at all. But what can I do?
In the city's most violent neighborhoods, officers frequently stop pedestrians and pull over cars searching for illegal guns. and police do take a lot of guns off the street. D.C. confiscates more illegal guns per capita than nearly any other big city. But those gun seizures and arrests are just part of the story, says Jim Trainum. He used to be a homicide detective on the D.C. police force. Now he works at a think tank and still lives in Washington.
Everybody looks at the arrest. Everybody, you know, focuses on all that. Look at the numbers behind it. How many cases get dismissed? How many cases actually result in a conviction?
But police don't track that, and neither do prosecutors. So we decided to compile our own data. Working with the Investigative Reporting Workshop at American University, we pulled 500 illegal gun cases from 2010 to 2015. What really stood out was this finding. Nearly 4 in 10 of these cases ended up getting dismissed in court. We ran this by Trainum. He wasn't surprised.
Stop and frisk is a good tool, but we've taken it and we've abused it over the years so that it's just another tool that we manipulate in order to get the stats, get the guns off the street.
Trainum says too often police stop and frisk residents without legal justification. Police must have reasonable suspicion to stop a person and temporarily detain them. And if they don't, the case can get tossed.
You know, oftentimes in cases we'll get a Fourth Amendment challenge.
U.S. Attorney for D.C. Jesse Liu says defense attorneys frequently argue that these arrests violate the Constitution, which protects against unreasonable search and seizure. But Liu doesn't see a systemic problem.
And I think that both the police department and our office are, you know, doing a great deal to train on what the legal requirements are.
Assistant D.C. Police Chief Robert Conti says court cases can get derailed for all kinds of reasons.
We are out here to get illegal guns, and it's not to, you know, violate anybody's rights or, you know, have a community uproar. That's not our intent.
Are you concerned about the high number of gun cases that get dismissed?
Sure, I'm concerned about that. But what I know is that that firearm that's been recovered off that street, it won't take the life of somebody.
But young black men say they feel targeted. Some feel resigned. To avoid being frisked, they say they lift up their shirts when police drive by to show they don't have a gun in their waistband. This summer, angry and exasperated residents from predominantly black neighborhoods testified at a D.C. council hearing.
We know it's real. We know that there is racial profiling in Ward 7 and 8.
Marianne Hopkins was among dozens of residents who lined up to the microphone. Later, a man who identified himself by his initials, DR, summed it up this way.
They look at everyone in the community like villains.
To understand why police were searching certain residents, we dug deeper into the court filings we pulled to look at the police affidavits. That's where officers say why they stopped someone in the first place. The most common justification? The suspect acted or looked suspicious. The suspect appeared nervous when they saw the cops. They crossed the street. They held their pants a certain way while walking. Robert Conti, the assistant police chief, said police know what they're doing. After all, these stops did end up with police confiscating illegal guns.
There are certain things that, as a law enforcement officer, that my eye is trained to see. And that behavior that I see is consistent with the person who's carrying a gun, I'm going to stop that individual.
Jim Trainum, the former D.C. detective, says this aggressive search for guns may work in the short term. Then, over time, it builds resentment.
Once we start cutting corners to make that stat, get that arrest, that's when you lose the trust of the community.
And if that happens, he says the job for police gets even harder. When you lose that trust, witnesses go silent, murders go unsolved, and the criminal with a gun is often back out on the street. So far this year, shootings have driven the homicide rate in D.C. up 40%. For NPR, I'm Patrick Madden.
Is that a real gun?
Yes, it's a real gun.
Do you kill people?
No, if some guy's hurting someone, I try to shoot him in the leg or something, just to stop him.
Mama says police misshoot black people.
Is it true? Yeah, is it true? Is that true?
A new museum in Washington, D.C. claims to provide a day-in-the-life look at the experiences of law enforcement officers, from local police to prison guards. But some people say it doesn't tell the whole story. Michaela LaFrac from member station WAMU reports. A tour of the new National Law Enforcement Museum begins with a movie. In a voiceover during the first scene at a police graduation, you hear a quote by the Greek philosopher Plato.
The greatest amount of power is given to those called the guardians.
After the music swells, the rest of the movie focuses on police forces around the country working harmoniously with their communities.
We all got to work together somehow.
Right. You need to prove yourself that you're actually going to be open and you're also going to tell people the truth.
Craig Floyd is the CEO of the National Law Enforcement Memorial Fund, the force behind the museum's development. He knows a lot of people don't trust police these days.
There's been a disconnect in some communities around this country over the last few years. I think this museum experience are going to go a long way toward building those bridges.
The $103 million museum was privately funded, mostly by corporations like Motorola and Glock. There are exhibits on different law enforcement career tracks and a video that follows a patrol officer throughout her day. But if you're looking for the museum's take on current protests over, say, officer-involved shootings, you won't find it. Lead exhibit developer Rebecca Looney says it's an all-ages museum.
And so when we talk about crime and murder and the more intense things, you're never confronted by something that you're not going to be able to handle.
That soft approach is clear in the Ferguson exhibit. It's the museum's only direct mention of an officer-involved shooting. Most of the exhibit is about body cameras, how they became more popular after black 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot and killed by a white policeman in 2014. That approach offends Black Lives Matter DC organizer April Goggins.
This is about propaganda. This is about providing a narrative and a picture of law enforcement that counters what we see in the news.
Retired Washington police officer Ron Hampton visited the museum recently. He also thinks it missed an opportunity to reach out to people who don't trust police.
Policing is a necessary component in our society. It can be better, but in order for it to be better, you have to work with it. So why not have that in the museum?
Hampton's the former head of the National Black Police Association. He urged the museum's planners to include stories of minority and women officers. He thought it'd help the different communities connect.
And I think every police officer ought to know something about the history of the institutions they work in.
Now, he says, he feels like the committee just didn't listen. David Brandt, the museum's director, says he sees its role differently.
We haven't propagandized history. We're giving you the reality of day in the life. History is what it is. So we're not really commenting on the news.
To him, bringing up movements like Black Lives Matter would just turn people away.
As soon as certain people hear Black Lives Matter, they react one way or the other. It creates a difficult setting to have a fair and objective and productive conversation.
So the museum's permanent exhibits don't mention it. Brandt does say he's planned educational programming and discussions on subjects like Ferguson's impact on policing. He hopes both police officers and community advocates will show up. For NPR News in Washington, I'm Michaela Lafrac.
Prison rebellion and the struggle against mass incarceration. You wouldn't know it from corporate media, but a struggle is going on across the nation. Against mass incarceration, prisoners are waging hunger strikes and other collective actions to give voice to Incarceration Nation, the manifestation of mass incarceration. In Pennsylvania, prisoners at the state's newest joint, the $400 million Phoenix Prison, planned phone and commissary fasts to protest the conditions, but the DOC preempted these actions with a statewide lockdown based on a bogus claim of drug exposures. Using such a pretext, state officials locked down the entire state for 2 weeks and afterwards imposed a draconian mail system that required friends and family of prisoners to mail letters to a screening business in St. Petersburg, Florida. So, despite the silence of the corporate media, prisons remain a place of agitation, of protest, and of resistance. Meanwhile, I thank you all for supporting our efforts in Philadelphia courts as we struggle to open up new appeals. As the late Fred Hampton said, the beat goes on. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
A young man named Emmett Till was lynched in August of 1955 in the small town of Bunning, Mississippi. He was 14 years old, an African-American boy from Chicago who was visiting his relatives. The case is decades old, but a recent book has spurred the Department of Justice to reopen another investigation. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports.
Duke professor Tim Tyson has written two civil rights history books that have brought national acclaim, but as the 59-year-old trundles around his large vegetable garden next to his house in Durham, North Carolina, Tyson still seems very much the small-town country boy.
Well, you know, the squirrels have it coming. They ate over half of my crop last year, and I'm afraid the Lord called some of them home this year. I buried him in the garden. I thought it poetic justice.
Tyson's first book, Blood Done Sign My Name, is a searing memoir of racial murder in his hometown of Oxford, North Carolina in 1970. His father, a Methodist minister, sided with the town's black community and was excoriated as a traitor to the white race. Tyson's life and worldview were never the same. A few weeks after publication, the author got a phone call. A fan was on the other end, raving about how much her mother-in-law loved his memoir and how she wanted to meet him.
You know, I sort of pretended she hadn't said it and thanked her very much and was getting off the phone. And then she said, "You might know about my mother-in-law. Her name was Carolyn Bryant."
Indeed, Tyson did. Carolyn Bryant had been at the center of one of the country's most notorious racial murders, the lynching of Emmett Till in the Mississippi Delta.
I went to her house. I walked in the door. She gave me a big hug. She served me pound cake and coffee, and she seemed like pretty much any kind of Methodist church lady I've ever known in my life.
But in 1955, Carolyn Bryant was a striking 21-year-old who'd married into a rough and violent working-class family. She and her husband, Roy, owned a small rural grocery store that catered to local sharecroppers. On August 24th, Carolyn was behind the counter when Emmett Till walked in with some friends to buy bubblegum. Tyson says what happened next remains a matter of dispute.
We do know a 14-year-old black boy from Chicago visiting his relatives in Mississippi had some kind of harmless encounter with a white woman, and her kinsman came in the middle of the night, snatched him away from his family at 2:30 in the morning, drunk men with guns, dragged him off, tortured him to death in a tool equipment shed in unspeakable ways, and threw his dead body in the river.
Authorities charged Carolyn Bryant's husband and her brother-in-law with Till's murder. In Bryant's statement to her lawyer, Carolyn described Till as sassy and disrespectful, that when he left the store, he turned around and said, "Bye, baby." But back in Till's hometown of Chicago, his mother, Mamie Till Bradley, held an open casket funeral for her son. Jet Magazine was there and published a big story along with a devastating photo of the badly mutilated child lying in repose. African Americans across the country were horrified and infuriated by what they saw. The powerful NAACP and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters took up the case. The angry and organized reaction across the nation reverberated back to Mississippi. So when Carolyn Bryant took the stand to testify in her husband's murder trial, her story had changed from what she told her lawyer.
She essentially told the age-old story of the black beast rapist. And it was a well-worn story that Southerners, black and white, have heard for a long time.
Bryant's story evolved. On the stand, she claimed the boy manhandled her and bragged he'd had sex with white women before. The all-white jury took about an hour to find the defendants not guilty. 5 decades later, Carolyn Bryant, now Carolyn Bryant Donham, told the Southern author she admired so much that what she testified to on the stand that day was a lie.
She started muttering, "Well, they're all dead now anyway." She said, of the attack, of the assault, of the sexual part, she said, "That part's not true."
Carolyn Bryant eventually moved from Mississippi to North Carolina, where she lives with her daughter-in-law, Marcia Bryant. In an interview with NPR, Bryant denied her mother-in-law had recanted to Tyson, saying what she said on the stand is what she said all along. She didn't change her story.
You would have thought that some of these things would have been put to bed.
Jim Coleman is a law professor at Duke University. Coleman says the Justice Department reopened the Till case once before back in 2004, but a Mississippi grand jury declined to take any further legal action. After this latest Till book was published, the FBI quietly reopened the case, asking for and receiving Tyson's notes and research this summer. Coleman is curious about the Justice Department's motives.
I don't see anything that would be accomplished by a federal reopening of the case other than the publicity of the Justice Department having reopened the case.
The Justice Department declined to comment to NPR about this latest investigation. The year after Till was murdered, Bryant's husband and brother-in-law admitted in a magazine article that they indeed had murdered the child, but claimed the boy deserved it. The case did more than shame the nation. It motivated to action an entire generation of black organizers.
I can remember even now standing on a street corner looking at that photograph with my friends of his body.
In 1955, Charles Cobb was the same age as Emmett Till, 14 years old. By 1962, Cobb left Howard University, where he was a student, and headed for the Mississippi Delta and became an organizer for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Those of us who made our way into the civil rights movement in the 1960s call ourselves the Emmett Till generation.
The men who murdered an African-American child from Chicago in order to further terrorize the local black community believed they had served the cause of white supremacy well. But in fact, they'd done anything but, though it would take another decade. Tyson says the seeds of the Voting Rights Act were actually planted in Mississippi in 1955 in the blood of Emmett Till. Wade Goodwin, NPR News.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today. The Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 1210-2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. Just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
Law enforcement made a major breakthrough today with the arrest of a Florida man accused of sending more than a dozen package bombs across the United States. The devices were addressed to prominent Democrats and critics of President Trump. This morning, FBI agents swarmed an AutoZone parking lot in South Florida and arrested 56-year-old Cesar Sayoc. That arrest came shortly after two more suspicious packages were identified. At a Justice Department news conference, FBI Director Christopher Wray said the investigation is just beginning.
Today's arrest doesn't mean we're all out of the woods. There may be other packages in transit now, so we need the help of everyone out there, every citizen, everyone in law enforcement, everyone we've got, to help with this investigation in the days to come.
At the same news conference, Attorney General Jeff Sessions said the suspect, quote, appears to be a partisan. Sayoc is a registered Republican and supporter of Donald Trump. Speaking at the White House today, President Trump commended law enforcement and called for an end to political violence.
We must never allow political violence to take root in America. Cannot let it happen. And I'm committed to doing everything in my power as president to stop it.
Katie Switalski reports for member station WLRN in Miami. She's been tracking developments today and joins us now from the site of the arrest. And Katie, first, what else can you tell us about the suspect?
So we know that Sayoc was here this morning at this auto zone just west of Fort Lauderdale, and he came in his big white van full of stickers, very pro-Republican, anti-liberal stickers. And it's still not clear if he was an employee at this auto zone or if he was just a customer shopping. But FBI agents swarmed the facility this morning right off a major highway and were looking through the computer system and questioning employees here. AutoZone does track customers by their cell phone number when they make a purchase. So FBI agents were here for a few hours looking through the computer system.
So that all went down this morning. What does the scene like now?
So it's still a media frenzy here, of course, but a little quieter. The store's been closed for the rest of the day, but a lot of customers have come up and tried to come in and get things like oil for their cars. And they've been pretty frustrated and wondering what's going on. But across the street, actually, a few people saw the arrest happen because NYPD and FBI agents were sort of doing a stakeout across the street with binoculars waiting for the moment to arrest Sayoc.
Wow, and I understand you spoke with one of those witnesses today. What did they tell you about what they saw?
I did. I spoke with a businessman right across the street from the auto zone, and he was telling me he knew pretty much right away when he saw NYPD and FBI agents that this was related to the suspicious packages and the pipe bombs mailed out this week. He said he just had a gut intuition that this was bigger than a small crime, and he actually saw Sayoc's face and his expressions the moment he was arrested.
He actually had a look on his face from what I saw of him, more of like just a, okay, they got me. You know, like he gave up kind of a thing, like, oh, I can't believe I did this.
And after Sayoc was taken away by FBI agents, his white van covered in these stickers that were anti-media, anti-liberal agendas, and pro-Republicans was taken away and towed off by the FBI to a facility in a neighboring city, and they covered it with a blue tarp to take it away.
Sayoc appears to have been very active on social media. What can you tell us about his postings there?
Yes. So for the past several weeks on Twitter, his posts have been very, very anti-Florida Democratic gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum. And his posts have really been attacking people that have donated to Gillum, supported Gillum, and he keeps screenshotting these negative campaign ads of Gillum. He seemed a little fixated.
All right, that's Katie Switalski of member station WLRN in Miami. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ari.
4 days since suspicious packages addressed to prominent Democrats began showing up around the country, authorities today arrested a 56-year-old man in Florida.
Though we're still analyzing the devices in our laboratory, these are not hoax devices.
FBI Director Christopher Wray said at a press conference today that fingerprints and possible DNA led authorities to the suspect, Cesar Sayoc.
We do believe that we've caught the right guy, but we also know that this is an ongoing investigation and there's a lot of work still to be done, which means there are still plenty of unanswered questions.
NPR's Martin Costi joins us now to talk more about this investigation. Hey there, Martin.
Hi, Audie.
So what more have we learned about Cesar Sayoc?
Well, as they've said there, he's 56 years old, lives just outside of Miami, north of Miami in Broward County. And the FBI said they identified him via fingerprint, and that's important because if the FBI can ID you that quickly from a latent print, you're probably in the system and you've probably been arrested a lot. And in fact, he has been. He has a record going back a couple decades for shoplifting, various kinds of theft. He was even charged at one point with altering his driver's license to so that he would look younger because he was single. In 2002, he was charged with threatening to throw an explosive device.
Now, do these previous crimes indicate a pattern of political grudges, though, or political violence? I mean, you mentioned that bomb threat that he had made.
Not really, as far as we can tell. I mean, he has been very active online, very pro-Trump. He's a registered Republican. But there's no indication before this that we know of that he's been involved in any kind of political violence or intimidation. His lawyer on some of those older criminal cases from about a decade and a half ago is named Ron Lowy. And he recalls that 2002 bomb threat situation as a case of his client losing his temper with a power company. He says that he was talking on the phone with them about a problem, and at some point he said, if maybe you'll give me better service if I throw a bomb at you. They called the police, and ultimately Lowy, his attorney, says prosecutors sort of concluded that there was no evidence that there was anything here more than immature, angry talk, no evidence that he could produce a bomb.
I believe he has issues comprehending concepts. I think he has maturity issues. He is like a little boy in a man's body.
A little boy in a man's body. Can we clarify that? Is he saying Sayoc has a mental disability?
He believes that Sayoc does. Lowy has known this family for years. They hired him originally to represent their son in those cases. And he just talked to the family right before he talked to me, and he says they're completely distraught. They don't share their son's politics. They've long wanted to get him some mental health help, but he refuses treatment. And Lowy doesn't know what kind of diagnosis he might have, but he believes that whatever it is, it's very serious, that Sayoc has trouble focusing on what people are saying, that he has trouble with concepts, abstractions. He also says Sayoc has lived in a van. Lowy doesn't recognize the van we've all seen in the news today that's been photographed with all those pro-Trump stickers on them on the van. But he says that when he knew Sayoc years ago, mm-hmm. Sayoc was also had a very distinctive-looking van.
He even then drove a vehicle covered with Indian memorabilia because he believed himself to be an American Indian when in fact he has no Indian blood. His mother is Italian. His father is Filipino. And his mother would tell him constantly, why do you keep telling people you're Native American? Why do you put these things on your car? I mean, these are very odd behaviors of someone who doesn't live in reality.
And Sayoc claimed to be Seminole, and the Seminole tribe has said today that they have no evidence in their records that he was.
All right. We'll continue to follow this story. NPR's Martin Costi, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You know, First Ladies usually have a cause. And you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt. And we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
Coberly Bull woke up to a notification.
Woke up Wednesday morning to a message.
The most hateful message she'd ever received in her life. It left her fearing for her kids.
Basically repeating himself about hoping my children would die and be hung. Because they're black. It was definitely racially motivated. You and your monkey children and using the N-word a lot.
Thinking maybe he was local, she called 911. Local for her is New Jersey.
So other people were able to look him up and go on his page easily.
The man had blocked her account, but friends found he lived hours southwest in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. How he got to her Facebook, she didn't know.
Something in the back of my head was like, this isn't right. Like, something's not sitting well.
Trusting her gut, she called police in Kentucky. That call put police on his street just in the nick of time. Kentucky State Police not using his name.
I won't mention him by name. And I won't glamorize him.
Told reporters the 20-year-old was pulling out of his driveway with hundreds of rounds of ammunition, a detailed plan of attack on two school districts. Bull had no way of knowing when she reported Dylan Jarrell she wasn't just protecting her kids.
I would hope that someone would, in the same situation, just do the same thing. Like, because you just obviously you never know. It could be an idle threat or it could be the next mass shooter that you're stopping. It's our future. These kids are our future. My kids, the kids of Lawrenceburg and Anderson County, they're our future, and we have to give them a fighting shot.
Caitlin Settner, WYMT Mountain News.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
Security guard stands at the door of the Jeffersontown Kroger as the store opens for the first time since two shoppers were shot dead. Employees leaning on each other for support as they try to move forward. The suspect, Gregory Bush, charged with gunning down two shoppers at that supermarket on Wednesday. 69-year-old Maurice Stallard was killed while buying poster board with his 12-year-old grandson. And 67-year-old Vicki Lee Jones was fatally shot in the parking lot. Today, a visitor's log sat inside the Kroger lobby so shoppers and employees could leave condolence notes for the victims' families. The Department of Justice says it is looking into the possibility that this is a hate crime. Police have not revealed a motive yet, but there are two theories as to what could have fueled the violence by suspect Gregory Bush. Wave 3 News reporter Caitlin Rust is joining us now to break down both of these discussions. Caitlin?
Police did interview Gregory Bush right after the shooting, saying he was cooperative to a point. We don't know what he told them, but there are facts that can't be ignored, both regarding his mental health, as well as a history of apparent racism and the targets he chose.
Court documents paint a narrative of someone struggling with mental illness, a judge even ordering mental health treatment. On his own Facebook page, Bush claims to be a paranoid schizophrenic who runs into trouble when off his medication. With mentions of suicidal tendencies and paranoia, Bush could be battling multiple conditions, and Dr. Joshua Yoon says it's common.
Depression, anxiety, anger, schizophrenia, unfortunately a lot of overlap, and so well, sometimes we have these boxes to label people's symptoms, but they may not fit perfectly into those boxes, that list of symptoms that they have.
Yoon says there's many variations of schizophrenia. Some are obvious and some are not, and it extends into all facets of life.
How quickly we seem to be so willing to say that someone who is anything other than black must be mentally ill. But when we have black perpetrators, we see that there are differences in how that gets handled.
But mental illness was not all Bush had a history with. Court documents show his ex-wife claimed he called her the N-word repeatedly. Sadiqua Reynolds with the Louisville Urban League feels important information is being forced out.
We need it reported. It looks like a hate crime. He went to a black church. He said whites don't kill whites. He murdered two black people. He has been known to use racial slurs. His Facebook page is horrible. This is a long history of racism, and that's what we need to call it, and we need to deal with it.
We have the full interview with Sadiqua Reynolds, as well as a more in-depth dive into some of the mental illness discussion on our website, wave3.com. Reporting in studio, Caitlin Rust, Wave 3 News.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, October 27th, 2018. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in, victims of white supremacy, non-white people. If you have views, questions, thoughts, suggestions, the number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Lots to share. A few things before we get to the callers. First of all, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Sincere, hearty gratitude to all of the listeners for nearly a decade keeping the cows on the air. I hope the program has been and continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Thanks also to numerous listeners who have invested nabbing items from my wish list at Amazon.com. It is linked under Gus T. Renegade. It is also linked at my blog. You can check out numerous items that I have there. Listener got me a superb yoga mat, one of the best. I think I've got like three different yoga mats from my wish list over the past year, but supremely grateful for all of the support. And again, I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Going down the list here before we get to the callers. In the segment where they were talking about Emmett Till and the FBI reopening the case, they said, without snickering, the powerful NAACP. They didn't even slip in my gag joke where they have the race soldier who says niggers, apes, alligators, coons, and possums. That's what the NAACP is. The powerful NAACP. Now, we're supposed to be being attentive to words. What do we mean when we say powerful? When I think of the NAACP and in that time period, the powerful NAACP, what are they going to do? What did they do in the Emmett Till case? Did they come and, you know, beat down some race soldiers? Did they get a conviction? Like, what are they going to do? Going through the list. March, boycott, take you to court, black robes, white justice, we shall overcome. I'm not saying this to disparage their efforts. Mr. Fuller said he was a member of the NAACP. Not saying this to disparage them, just what do we mean when we say powerful, especially in the context of system of white supremacy? What do we mean when we say powerful? Because I think there is a pattern of suggesting that black people are more powerful than we are in a system of white supremacy. In my view, the NAACP, Gus T. Renegade, any victim of white supremacy, all of these folks are in a very weak position in relationship to the power that racist man, racist woman, racist child have. They are the powerful one. Carolyn Bryant Dunham, she is powerful. They didn't describe her as powerful. They described her as striking, which I also thought was wow, because that the same thing Dr. Tyson, suspected racist who sat on that information for a decade, that this white woman, suspected racist, lied about the murder of Emmett Till, the lynching of Emmett Till, that she lied about this. He didn't go take that information to enforcement officials immediately and say, oh my gosh, murder, there's no statute of limitations. This racist heifer lied here. Here you go. Let me hand this out. I got photocopies and I had it notarized and everything. That's not what he did. He sat on it or he held that information. He did not share that information for years. We talked about this with Keith Beauchamp. He was a guest on the program some years back. He did a definitive documentary, The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till. He's actually been a guest on the program multiple times, but specifically, he was a guest on the program last year to talk about this case. Continuing, the segment where they had the black mother in Flint, Michigan, where they were talking about the whole water situation, and they said they've kind of went back to speak to her numerous times over the years and checking to see how she was doing. And her son came in, 9 years old, to ask, you know, what happened? What's up with this water problem? And she said, you know, she was trying to explain. And then when the reporter, who I suspect is a white person, when he said, you know, how would you have answered that question if it had been someone not your son? And then when she, you know, got emotional and said she would have mentioned racism, and she said that she didn't want her children to be racist. striking moment in that segment. The first thing that came to my mind was, you should listen to the context of white supremacy so that you have an accurate definition of racist. Words are very important. Accurate definition of racism. It is not possible for you all, victims of white supremacy, victims of chemical and biological warfare until proven otherwise, it is impossible, regardless of what you think about any of the whites, even the white man holding the microphone during the interview, it is impossible for you to be a racist, just having a basic understanding of what racism is and how it works. But that was profound because I've heard that so many times over the past decade, just in general, about how do you talk to your children. And in my view, you tell them the truth. You tell them the truth. It does not have, Dr. Welsing used to say that all the time. You do not, it's not about hating white people. But when the child is ready to learn and is asking questions, you present them with accurate information. And I think particularly, and that's, can you imagine being a black child, eczema, you've had skin problems, been subjected to biological warfare. You got to go stand in line to get bottled water for years, the formative years in your development as a human being. And you got to get bottled water to take a shower, to brush your teeth, all of these health problems, you and your whole family, stress for years. And this does not get explained as an act of racism. You get, pardon the metaphor, but you get buckets of words. Not an indictment. She's a victim of racism, but I'm just saying, I've heard this a lot. It is so, so important that we find ways and share information so that we can accurately talk to our children about what is happening to us and how we are being terrorized in all areas of people activity. It is critically, vitally important that we do so. Continuing. I can pause from some of the serious antics and give chronicles from Gus T. Renegade's yoga adventures. So this week, really, this is kind of a retrospective on the month. So at various studios, they have like a monthly challenge to, it'll either be to see if you can take a class every day of the month or to see if you can take a set number of classes during the month. It'll be just different things to, you know, try to motivate you to continue to practice. So they're doing that at the studio that I practice at, the challenge to see how many classes that you can take, and you get a discount. You get a bigger discount the more classes that you take. So since I have been doing my yoga in response to being a Floyd victim and a victim of white supremacy, since about March, April, I've been taking about 60 classes per month. Every month, pretty much. Sometimes more than that due to teacher training where you are required to take a lot of classes. And this month, no different. As of today, the 27th, I've taken 53 classes. A little bit below what I would normally do. I had prenatal teacher training, which took up a lot of time, but that's where it is right now, 53 classes. So they have a board up in the studio, and if you're doing the challenge thing, it has your name, and then it has checks for the number of classes that you've done, right? I had taken 31 classes, I think, within the first 15 days of the month, which is normal. As of today, no one has taken 31 classes. And from what it looks like on the schedule, no one at the studio will take 31 classes. So this is very visible. Negro, I wear my please treat me like a white person shirt or the other one. Every time that I go to class, pretty much, I'm the only Negro male present. So very flagrant, my presence at this studio. So over the course of the month, as people have been looking at the board in the front of the room and seeing, you know, one row that has all of these checks way more than anybody else, it stands out again flagrantly. So what's happened is whites who normally do not speak to me, whites that I don't know, excuse me, will come up and be like, wow, you have all those, that's you? You've got all those checks up there. Again, paying attention to words. So these are some of the descriptors that they have used. You've taken all those classes. That's crazy. You've taken all those classes. You're a lunatic. I'm going to fast forward to one of the best of the month. You've taken all those classes. I look up there and I see all those X's, and it's so intimidating. I had my Bill Cosby moment for this one. I said, intimidating? Taking yoga classes is intimidating? Bill Cosby moment is a metaphor. My apologies. I had a moment where I thought of Pennsylvania inmate Bill Cosby and how easily black males, Emmett Till, can be accused of threatening, raping, recklessly eyeballing a white woman. This was a white woman, suspected racist, who was saying, I look and I see all of your checks on the board, and it's so intimidating. And I said, intimidating? Taking yoga classes? Really? And she said, question. And she said, you're right. That is not the best word. And she stopped and she thought and she said, dedicated. Pause. That word dedicated again. Dedicated. Inspiring. Another word I've mentioned a lot this year. So she came up with better descriptors. So within about 3 or 4 days, a different white woman, suspected racist, she comes by. She said, I've seen all of your checks. How many classes have you taken now? And I said, I don't know, something, I don't know, over 30. I stopped counting. She said, that is crazy. The suspected racist that I had corrected previously, who said I was intimidating, she called out and she said, dedicated, inspiring, pick a different word. And the white woman corrected herself, which told me that she, and even, I can even pause, the white woman who said that that's crazy, this is the same white woman. They count classes. That they do this at all the studios. They obsessively count classes, in my opinion. I had taken 100 classes at the studio. The same white woman was there. They do like a brief celebration type thing for how many, if you've taken 100 classes or whatever. She was there, and she says, over in the corner there, we were in Shavasana, where you get to lay down and just relax at the end of class. So I'm lying down doing what you're supposed to do for Shavasana. And she says, over there in the corner. Now, Gus might look like he's sleeping, but he's actually taken 100 classes, and he actually did it faster than anyone at the studio. And I mentioned before, supposed to be a compliment, but they still managed to slip in an insult. Still got to get in our nigger joke, like, snoozing lazy nigger actually did take a lot of classes, but he's still nigger. That's what I mean, and I think a lot of people have noted that pattern of even when it's supposed to be celebratory, a congratulations of sort. You've done something well. We need to compliment this nigra. It's so hard. It's so hard that they even then end up selecting some sort of derogatory word or word that is not quite a celebration of what you're doing. It's not quite a word that would generally fit the occasion. In fact, if you were a white person, they probably would have said something else. And I've said that repeatedly. If I were a white person, I think it'd be a totally different response. Wow, so inspiring. What a Nick. Bravo. Three cheers for continuing. The segment in Washington, D.C., they were talking about the confiscation of handguns. The black male, when he said he was talking about being stopped and fondled, I think he used the word frisked, but he said he had to hand over his manhood. Dr. Tommy Curry. Our next book for the book club. Book club is rotating to Thursdays now. Workplace Racism will be on Friday. The book club will be on Thursday. And again, this is to accommodate some of our participants who are outside the United States. They said it would be easier if Workplace Racism were on Friday. That way they don't have to work Saturday, so they could stay up late and join us. So Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Dr. Tommy Curry, The Man Knot. I am so looking forward to it. We are motivated to read this because of Black Love is a Revolutionary Act being so rife with Black misandry. Worst book that I've ever read, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. And being equally, Gus T, being equally stunned with the response from readers, listeners who read or chimed in, listened to a book that was filled with flagrant anti-black male content, and many of whom found no problem with it. Dr. Curry, this Thursday, starting his book with his blessings, The Man Knot. If you need a copy of the book, you should be able to access one before Thursday. Next, Charles Cobb. He was in the segment on Emmett Till. Incidentally, when I was listening to Emmett Till, that segment, what kept coming in my mind because of the Black misandry in Black Love as a Revolutionary Act, I was thinking, Emmett Till, he was feverish. They interviewed Charles Cobb in that segment. He's has been a guest on The Cows. We talked about his book, That Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, where he talked about the long history of Black people engaging in self-defense against race soldiers. This broadcast, I've already talked a lot about the importance of words and metaphors. Wow, we had some doozies. The seeds of the Voting Rights Act are in the blood of Emmett Till. That was one of the metaphors. Another metaphor that we had for Cesar Sayoc, I hope I'm saying his name correctly. This is the suspected race soldier who has been accused, charged of sending these package explosive devices. He was described by his attorney as a little boy in a man's body. I believe this gentleman, or excuse me, I believe the suspected race soldier, suspected terrorist, is in his 50s, but a little boy in a man's body. Mr. Mumia Abu-Jamal, in the segment talking about the prisons, he quoted Fred Hampton and said, the beat goes on. I don't know what that means. If someone can explain, I would need a lot more detail to grasp what is meant. I accumulated all of these just to say this is the compensatory call-in. I do request that we not use metaphors. I have to prompt myself about that sometimes, as I've done already. But frequently, racists, they will use metaphors to practice racism. A little boy in a man's body. Practicing racism, master deceivers. They will also, a lot of times, they will take two separate concepts, entities, and they'll say, oh yeah, these are identical, twins. And frequently, that is not the case at all. Victims of racism, including myself, we have been exposed to this behavior for a long time, and many of us, we are still learning. Sometimes we don't have all of the information, the logic, to articulate our views, so we will substitute and use a metaphor or an analogy of some sort, and frequently it just adds to confusion. If we could be specific, explicit, direct about what we are saying, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Last thing that I will share before we get to the callers, the segment, or two things, the segment where they were talking about Mr. Sayoc, I think that's how they were saying his name. The guy, the white suspected racist who's charged with the package bombs, where they were talking about the stickers and things that he had on the white van that he was in, allegedly. And they said that his on his social media pages, he had all this content where he was upset about Mr. Gillum, the black male who's running for governor. I think he was the one where they said, are we going to monkey around and put this nigger in office? That was just, you know, a few weeks back that they said this. Why is Mr. Sayoc not being described as a suspected racist? I looked at the people that they listed that he's accused of having sent some sort of package or device to. Eric Holder, former attorney general, U.S. Senator Cory Booker, Barack and Michelle Obama, U.S. Congresswoman Maxine Waters, Robert De Niro, and I think that is a cowbell for Mr. De Niro. I think his spouse is a non-white female. Disproportionate number of black people. I know he also sent packages to the Clintons, allegedly, and George Soros, other individuals classified as white, but a lot of, way too many black people included in this. That, in addition to his animosity directed towards Mr. Gillum, why is he not being described as a suspected racist? A suspected terrorist. race soldier, all of the above. I haven't heard that. In addition, the case in Kentucky, Gregory Bush, this is different race soldier who went to the Kroger and killed two black people explicitly. In fact, I wanted to read a little bit of this. I forgot I had this. I'm reading from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I got it right in front of me. Police accused Kroger shooter tried to get inside black church 10 minutes before killings. Did people hear about this? Be more longtime listener, investor. She posted this on my page, Facebook page, earlier in the week. Did people hear about this? Because I feel like this should have been directly connected to the white man being arrested in Florida and even the other incident that happened in Kentucky where this white man was going to go and shoot up these schools. But they nabbed him before he was able to carry out his act. All three of these should have been triangulated. They happened the same week, within days, within hours of each other. And white identity extremists, why haven't they issued the report? The AJC, again, the title, accused Kroger shooter tried to get inside black church 10 minutes before killings. I'm not going to read the whole article. The white man accused of gunning down two black customers at a Kentucky grocery store Wednesday tried minutes before the shooting to enter a predominantly black church, according to police officials. Jeffersontown Police, Jeffersontown Police Chief Sam Rogers on Thursday told reporters that Gregory Allen Bush Sr. tried to get into the First Baptist Church of Jeffersontown about 10 minutes before he opened fire at a nearby Kroger, killing Maurice Stallard, 69, and Vicki Lee Jones, 67, both of Louisville. Both victims suffered multiple gunshot wounds, Rogers said. Stallard, who the Louisville Courier-Journal reported was at Kroger buying a poster board with his 12-year-old grandson, was shot inside the store. Jones was killed in the parking lot. Let's see. I'm trying to get specifically to the portion where they're talking about the church. Okay. Here we go. Bush is charged with 2 counts of murder and 10 counts of wanton endangerment, according to jail records. His bail has been set at $5 million. Rogers said Thursday that a tip from a city employee who saw Bush near the church right before the shooting led investigators to the church's security cameras. The footage showed Bush trying to get inside. He was unsuccessful gaining access to the church, Rogers said. WDRB in Louisville reported that a church member in the parking lot spotted Bush banging on the church doors and trying to open them. Church officials said the timing of Bush's arrival was fortunate because he arrived after a midday church service had concluded. Loss of life anywhere is pretty tragic, but just to think that an hour and a half earlier, we had 70 people in the church, church administrator Billy Williams told the news station. But by the time he came through, all doors were locked and there were probably 8 or 10 people still in the building. I'm scrolling down just to get the last bit. Okay, here we go. Once the scene was secure and the suspect was in custody, we had the daunting task of identifying and interviewing a multitude of witnesses, Rogers said. One of the more than 120 witnesses who had to be interviewed was Ed Harrell, who told the Courier-Journal that he was waiting in the parking lot for his wife when he heard gunshots. He grabbed his own revolver and crouched down next to his car, the Courier-Journal reported. I'd like to know if this was a white person or a non-white person who was armed on the scene. Harrell told the newspaper he saw the gunman walk nonchalantly through the parking lot, gun at his side. Harrell called out to him, asking what was going on. "Don't shoot me. I won't shoot you. Whites don't shoot whites," Bush said, according to Harrell. Well, I got my answer there. I didn't know he was talking to this gentleman. But yeah, I thought that was, that should have been front page every time with this report. And again, this should have been connected. If you're going to do proper journalism, you put all this in context. Look what happened just in the last 7 days. White men run amok, explicitly practicing racism, white supremacy. It's white terrorism. And again, did we, Bill Cosby branded a terrorist. All three of these individuals easily should have been branded a terrorist, and it should have been collective white terrorism. Anyway, just making sure if folks did not hear about the Kroger incident, because I thought that was hugely significant. If you did not hear, that would be good to know if this is folks' first time hearing about the situation in Kentucky down at the Kroger. I will stop there. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you could take 5 minutes, make sure I get my reminder in, 5 minutes to share thoughts, observations, make sure everyone gets at least one chance to share. And if you could use your mute button, especially if you are in a noisy environment, please use your mute button so that we don't have to grapple with a lot of unnecessary background disturbances. Much obliged. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Good evening, guys. Can I be heard?
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, sir. I had a few comments to make. This week, Matthew Shepard was mentioned. Homosexual crackhead laid to rest at the Natural Cathedral. Got a big ceremony, family giving enough treatment of a fallen soldier hero gets. No mention of James Byrd. No James Byrd family members were there to get their ceremonial white validation. But I thought that was interesting because we were just talking about him. White Jewish synagogue shot up today. They did a lot of comparing to the Emmanuel Africa, African Methodist Episcopal Church in North Carolina, Dylan Roof, and making this incident much worse. So I'm watching the coverage today, including the press conference. I went back and watched the press conference from the North Carolina church shooting. And, you know, and remember, a state senator was assassinated in this shooting in North Carolina. The attention to detail that they were put on display today, if you needed proof of a system, it was there. Just watch both of those press conferences and compare. Megyn Kelly, you know, she's been making racist comments for years. I first took notice of her when she said that Jesus was white and Santa was white. And I agreed with her. But a lot of people being classified as black didn't. They were angry. Symbol formation, Dr. Wells's definition, Jesus and Santa symbols. The whole career that she had was having these outspoken racist views, sort of like Hannity and Bill O'Reilly and all the rest of them. One of the worst things she said to me that was explicitly racist was when she called Michelle Obama Barack Obama's baby mama. I thought that was outright racist. Regular guest on her show, her police expert was Mark Furman. Please type in Cochran Furman tapes, and from the John Cochran's law firm website, you can read the transcripts from the Furman tapes. Some of the most explicitly racist stuff you'll ever read. Megan was fired. She gets to keep, I think, $69 million. Remember, she was one of the top people coming out with this Me Too movement, talking about sexual misconduct of white males at Fox News. Racist Travis Binking walked into a Waffle House in Nashville earlier this year, I think in February, shot 6 non-white people, killing 4 of them before he got his AK-47 or AK-15, whatever, wrestled away from him. Never called the act of racism. That's what the Cougars Louisville thing reminded me of. White man kills 2 black people, 1 inside and 1 outside, and ask another white man not to shoot him because he was white. If that's not racism, I don't know what is, but they're not calling this an act of racism. And yes, I did read the article about the church. He went there before he went to Cougars. Dylan Roof, again. Flint lead. Lead causes brain defects in babies, and it causes learning defects in children. and its uncorrectable and uncurable health problems. Lead paint removal, I have mixed feelings about. Technology, in my opinion, should be added to the nine areas. Lead paint, due to its metallic compound, will block out and at least decimate the 5G nanorays. And I think that that's important to know. And I wonder why the removal in all major cities, is it due to protect the people, or are they doing this to be able to interact with you using this 5G? The stop and frisk. Stop and frisk is a metaphor for what is initially called CompStat when it came out in the 90s, a computer program called Compared Statistics, CompStat. They have been data mining us in live time and with real people for over 20 years. And right now it's in Detroit, Baltimore, San Juan. It's hard to get more non-white than San Juan. Philly, L.A., New York, Nashville, D.C., all major cities with non-white population of majority or have large areas where there's a lot of non-white people that are cohabitating. And they also all cities that's being gentrified. The new CompStat and Stop and Frisk is going to be called Predictive Policing. It's an upgrade from a program that the police use to input data to a set of algorithms that's based off that data that the police mined all those years, that they can, pretty much the computer will tell them where the next crime's going to happen and how to assist in that crime. Once again, technology should be added to the nine areas. I'll mute my line. Thank you, guys.
No mention of James Byrd Jr. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. This is Victor out of New Jersey. What Thomas just was talking about, predictive policing, sounds like something off of the Minority Report. and we talked about lead in the water. I'm from New Jersey, and Newark, New Jersey is also going to have their issues concerning lead. The officials are talking about it and really kind of making it seem like it's really not a big issue. So, you know, they're not warning, they're not directly telling people not to drink the water, but indirectly they're saying don't drink the water. Megyn Kelly, I don't think that was the worst thing that she has said throughout her history on television. I'm assuming that maybe there's something else. Maybe NBC is trying to get her out of the contract, and they just use that as a way to dismiss her. However, her apology, white race soldiers, when they try to come across as they were unaware of the racial stereotypes that was damaging, that's damaging to victims of racism, black people. They are not dumb. I've come to the conclusion that it's just entertainment for them. They enjoy mocking us. The stop and frisk. They spoke about identifying people who look suspicious. It's real amazing that they can find so many reasons to stop and frisk black victims. But however, there is no suspicion. I mean, no matter how suspicious the white race soldier may look, they get a pass. The bomber, I mean, you know, from understanding, he was riding around with Donald Trump plastered all over his van. He would be seen frequently taking baths in the ocean on the beach. People said that he was suspicious, but nobody picked up the phone. Nobody informed authorities. So regardless of what white race soldiers do, nothing suspicious until one day they shoot up a school or they're sending bombs through the mail. I'm going to close with this interesting story that wasn't on the news, that wasn't on any of the segments. Today at work, I made a delivery in front of an abortion clinic. Suspected white Christian race soldiers was out there with signs speaking out against abortion. When I glanced at the signs, there was nothing but black fetuses. That's what I noticed. I seen there was a black fetuses and a black woman victim walks up. Suspected race soldiers put their arms around her and I guess tried to deter her for entering the clinic. They had no reason of knowing why she was entering the clinic. She could have been, I don't know, could have worked there. But it was just interesting of the psychology of race soldiers, suspected race soldiers, that they care about a fetus, but once that fetus reaches adulthood, they can care less what happens, whether it's unemployment, police brutality, or just being gunned down in the church by race soldiers. I'll close with that.
Fascinating observation. Much obliged, sir. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. I'm reminded of Ma'afa 21 from way back, 2009. Seems very similar. That documentary film about abortion done by whites. You can go back and listen in the archives. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
I'll wait. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
It's Jay in St. Louis. I wanted to make a couple of comments. I don't want it to be employed as a metaphor. I want it to be taken literally. It's the notion of plantation politics and the structure of the world as a plantation. And I think what really gets to the heart of it is it weaves together with some of the stories you let us hear. So number one is Megyn Kelly. Megyn Kelly has been employed by large media conglomerates in the United States for some time. She said these things on a number of occasions in different ways as they covered. But I wanted to note how, as she made her apology, the crowd was filled with non-white black people. That's very unusual for that show. It's very mainstream, very targeted to white, middle-aged women as an audience. So all of a sudden, when she's apologizing, it's filled with black people. And then all of the black anchors from those various networks are allowed to speak. And so going with the plantation as a conception of this landscape, what you realize is the headmasters of this plantation have always been able to stratify and split up the group of the slaves and elevate them at will and give them the authority to speak. And that ties into the second notion, this notion of invisibility. It goes with another story we heard about with black women and breast cancer. It was mentioned that the way they were able to isolate the data that they eventually found and get to the heart of some of the, not the heart, or get to the factors that they were describing was to change the methodology and who they surveyed and how it was unusual for black women to be surveyed and for their problems to be centered in the research. So going forward with that invisibility is also the stratification and the puppeting of black bodies in advance of white interests. And that showed itself not only in the case with Flint, Michigan, where we had President Obama go and fake sip water twice to patronize the crowd, but also the police chief, the National Association of Black Police Officers. And I wanted to make, lastly, I wanted to make note on that story about that museum. I'm really going to keep up with it because I think the person they interviewed definitely stated correctly that that is about propaganda. Museums and white supremacist culture have always had this role of memorializing and consecrating images of whiteness, establishing the memory, the social consciousness of the space in which it exists. And I also wanted to point out that that was started, that article highlighted a quote by Plato, who's the ancient Greek philosopher. Plato's philosophy is, I recommend everybody to read it. It's particularly important because of Plato's conception of the soul. And I won't go into all of it, but it has a tripartite structure. I'll just summarize it quickly. It has a tripartite structure. Reason is one of them. And then it's two horses. The one horse is white and the other one is black. And Plato's conception of humanity, the black horse needs to be tamed. And that's a good, balanced, moral soul. When the ugly black horse that's associated with everything bad is in its proper place, and the nice white horse with this anguiline European features is allowed to run freely and tamed by reason. So, and then I'll cut my commentary there. Thank you for letting me speak.
Much obliged, Jay in St. Louis. Your mention of the horse reminded me of Shadow. Mr. Fuller was talking about the horse that was the black horse that was abused, and then they changed its name to Justice. But yeah, we can't let the black horses get out of control. Thank you, Emmy, for yielding the floor. Did you want to speak?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, beautiful people. The first clip that I wanted to talk about was the breast cancer clip. And the entire clip was slightly problematic, in my opinion. But one thing that I really wanted to highlight was they wanted to keep making it seem as though non-white, specifically black people or people classified as black women or females, are dying from breast cancer at higher rates than white women, more so due to like this emotional thing, you know, like the resilience factor, as they say. And I'm not removing any scientific legitimacy that that may have. I do, however, think that when the conversation scientifically, when it comes to people classified as non-white, particularly black, always revolves around being emotional and all these like feelings and stuff like that. And really, like there is enough scientific evidence to suggest that we are physiologically different from other groups of people. And that difference, like, we don't even really consider developing drugs to target that difference that could work for us. And for me, that is one of the, at this point, like with my studies and everything, I think about that all the time, that we really are physiologically different, meaning like we have receptors that maybe other people don't, or our receptors act differently than other people's do, in which case there are potential drug targets that are even better than the drugs that are being created for other groups of people that could cure our thing or work better for us or have no side effects. So developing an experiment where we're going to get together and have some type of motivational conversation, and that's supposed to be scientifically relevant to help treat black females' breast cancer, was disrespectful on many levels. And inappropriate, because you could develop one to develop drugs that work better to target cancer. Anyway, that was one thing. The other thing was the clip in Flint. I thought that was probably one of the craftiest racist clips that I had heard this evening. They all, you know, were littered with it, but the one about Flint, they were so crafty in it. Because again, with that emotionalism and continuously making the conversation, we're like asking us questions to evoke emotion or framing our responses to be more emotional instead of logic based. And so this is, I would argue, part of what prevents us thinking of solutions Not to say that people aren't, I'm sure they are, but they're not highlighted in the clips. And so it's just about how we feel about things. And I just don't see that as being constructive. There's really no evidence that that's working for us. And it was especially towards the end that I was just like, yeah, I got to make a note about that. You know, she gets very emotional and, you know, she talks about what she would have said if the person wasn't her son, the child wasn't her son. And she talks about racism. And then he turns around, and I'm presuming or assuming that this is a white male interviewer, and he says, this is about government and being able to have your voice heard with government. And I was just like, that's so slick. Like, man, you know, they are so super refined. Moving on. So then also for the clip about the museum in D.C., you know, anyway, so the law enforcement officer uses the term fair towards the end of the clip. I think that would make a really great sound clip for how the use of the word fair is problematic. It'd be great to hear it again. I'll probably listen to the archive, but that was the only way that I could really frame that note, is because we always talk about why the use of the word fair is problematic, because it equates, you know, whiteness with rightness and whatnot. But the way that he said fair, and it's, you know, it was like you could hear how it functioned in both ways. Maybe it was just me. Anywho, and then when it came to Trump addressing political violence, this is something I've been thinking about, that part of the reason that the white people who are, you know, saying these things are being punished or chastised by other white people is that they're breaking the code. And it's not so much that the white people disagree with the thing that the other white person is saying, but that you're not supposed to say it. And when you say it, you're kind of breaking down the ultimate bigger strategy that could be in play. And in addition to that white code, while Trump is saying no to the political violence, his tone, like when I closed my eyes and listened to it, I could hear the smirk. And I know that that translates far beyond the words, because I think there's enough evidence to suggest that white people function very much like that. Like they enjoy that type of double speak, you know, nature. But again, that could just be me. I think that's actually it. So I appreciate you all for listening.
Much obliged, Emmy. There's a great sound clip of President Trump where he's commenting about the violence, right? And he's saying, oh, we need to tone down the divisiveness and the rhetoric and all. And he says, do you hear my tone? Do you hear how nice I'm being? It's almost like he's mocking, to your point about the tone and being able to, the context with doublespeak, as they say, where you can say one thing with your literal text, but there can be a lot of nonverbal communication. I think that's something that you and Roz talk about regularly. Others that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, line should be open.
Hello, may I be heard?
Greetings, Irie.
Good evening to the host. Good evening to the listeners and participators. I have a list and I will try to be concise. Okay, so to the gentleman in New York who went first, in regard to his comment about adding technology to person activities, I completely agree with that. And I say that because I'm not sure how many people are abreast to the 2033, I believe, plans for the United States to finally send people out to begin the colonization of Mars. And the only thing I can think when I've read about it is white supremacy is jumping planets. And I'm not trying to say that as a metaphor. It's literal. And this is going to be a whole new dynamic in regard to non-white people, especially black descendants of slaves. The creed, I can't remember exactly what it's called with the rifle. This is my rifle. This is my gun. I've heard you play it before. But this time when I heard it, it made me think of a conversation I had with someone about the police being a paramilitary force. A lot of veterans join the police. The police are basically the people who have been hired by businesses to protect their property, whether it's intellectual, resource, whatever. And then because I thought of that, it made me think, Gus, if this may be something to consider studying in the future. And I know this might deserve a cowbell, but Black's Law Dictionary. And the reason I say that is because just like with Mr. Neely Fuller's word guide, in accordance to speaking in a codified way and consistent way, we also need to know the codification of the system we live in. And a big part of that is learning what they would call, quote, legalese. And the last comment I had to make is to Emmy. I agree with your comment completely about them withholding not only information, but things that could successfully treat, if not cure, illnesses that we are inundated with. And the reason I support that as well is because once I got out of the military, I got a temp job at a pharmaceutical company and had a rapport with a doctor who was also non-white Black. We had lunch one day and she basically told me that they were developing new drugs, XYZ. They were almost ready for like human efficacy studies. But then she said to me, and I quote, and she said it with a kind of delight because it guaranteed her career. She said, quote, but you know we're not in the business of curing. And when she said it, I had never thought about it in those terms or in that context before. And that is what it is. They are going to continue to milk us and experiment on us through medical apartheid and profit off of it every chance they get. Thank you very much, everybody, for bearing with me. I'll mute my line.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for sharing. Milk us, that is a metaphor, although that is kind of a cow reference, so should have maybe not said anything. Context of white supremacy. Number again, 641-715-3600. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Good evening. May I share something? It's B from Toronto.
Greetings. I just saw Drake's new video this week.
Oh, geez. Yes. Good evening to callers, listeners, and guests. Congratulations on achieving the prenatal yoga certificate, or as well as the other certificate that you had in yoga as well, too. And wishing you much success in putting it into practice as well.
Much obliged. Thank you kindly.
So, yes, I was listening to some of the clips, and I noticed that there continues to be a trend that is within most of the clips that you aired tonight. The first trend I found was the use of the double bind. For those who are not familiar with the double bind technique, the purpose of that technique is to cause extreme emotional distress. It can lead to contextual schizophrenia over long-term exposure. And what it is designed to do is it is designed to, again, create that emotional distress in which the person who is the recipient of this technique, they will not be able to find a resolution, and they would not be able to opt out of the reoccurring trauma. And the way it works is that no matter what the person does, it could be something positive, It could be something that is looked upon from the other party as negative. It will always be wrong. So, for instance, Gus, when you were talking about the amount of classes that you took and the reactions that you're receiving from the self-described white females, saying that they're telling you that, oh, it's insane and it's intimidating. This is part of the double bind technique, right? In that no matter how well you do, there's always going to be a negative connotation attached to it. There's always going to be a sly insult next to it. Also when I listen to the workplace, neutralizing workplace racism, that's a technique that is often used as well. Again, no matter what you do in your performances, you could be exemplary in your job performance, but no matter what, they're always going to find something. So what I've come to the conclusion is, not that you're looking for validation or that anyone's looking for validation, but in the event that they are unintentionally for non-white people, don't look for validation where people despise you. And guaranteed, white people do despise non-white people. So that was one trend that I was noticing through the clip. The next trend that I noticed through the clip is the use of mental illness. And I work in the industry where I'm working with people, mind you, through an agency. I'm working with people diagnosed with a dual diagnosis. It could be neurological. It could be mental illness, addictions, what have you. And I notice even with some of the colleagues that I work with, they seem to parade around that they have depression. This is mainly white females and white males. They parade around the fact that they either have depression, that they've been a part of the ASD or autistic spectrum disorder, that they, they've been, addicted to alcohol or drugs in the past. And the thing that I've noticed with them, and even with criminals as well, what I've noticed is that they are very proud of it. And I got curious as to why they seem really proud of, things that would be considered as a disorder or a pathology in their personality, or their biological makeup. And the main thing is that when they have a diagnosed disorder or addiction, they can use that to claim disability, which they can get additional money for it, additional support around. So for instance, not too long ago in Toronto in particular, there was a expose on the Toronto Police Services where there was a certain amount of police officers that were charged with DUI, but were not allowed to, they didn't leave the force, they weren't fired. They just simply went on disability. I noticed in other situations, say at my workplace, had supervisors who have been tested positive for drugs, but they weren't fired, they went on disability. And the thing is that under the human rights code that we have, you cannot fire a person for having a disability. So regardless, they can still engage in whatever bad behavior that they're doing, that they choose to do, that they are cognitive of doing, but it's mitigated because it's under the umbrella of disability. So they know very well as to what to pick and choose, and they know their terms very well, and they know how to use the system very well, because after all, they're part of a system that's beneficial for them, and their ancestors designed this system. So it's not surprising if the bomber, who was described by the lawyer as a little boy in a man's body, it wouldn't be surprising if somehow his charges are mitigated to some degree due to mental illness. It wouldn't be surprising. So the third trend that I noticed is what I term as racial gaslighting. And we definitely see the remnants of racial gaslighting in that, and I'll give you the term of that. Racial gaslighting is when the racialized group, which is white people, and or white identified could also be included into this group, use gaslighting techniques. And what the gaslighting techniques are is it's designed to alter your reality, and it's also designed to make you question your reality, and it can drive one insane after a certain time of exposure. So it could be little things such as, you know, saying a racist slur, and then when you're saying, excuse me, what did you say? Oh, I didn't say anything. You know, it could be something as simple as that. It could be moving around items on your desk. It could be removing resources from your area that you need to do your job or you know, what have you. It's about altering your environment so that it causes you to question, and it alters, it causes you to question, you know, if you've heard what you heard, if you've seen what you've seen. And the reason why I say that I could see the effects of it is because when the mother for the Flint quote or Flint clip mentioned that, if it was someone other than her son, then she would have told them that, you know, what they're doing is racist, but she doesn't want her son to be racist. It's almost as if it's just questioning as to whether racism really exists. And, you know, it alters her reality as to what racism really is, which is that on her part as a non-white, she cannot commit racism. But to her, she might be committing racism if she tells her child the truth, which is a complete skew on her reality, which makes it even harder to solve the problem. So I hope I'm making, if you need more clarity, please let me know. But those are the three trends that I've noticed. I think that the more aware that we are of these techniques, the more aware that we can be in combating it. So thank you, and I leave the line.
Good to hear from you. Be in Toronto, racism, white supremacy, known universe. South Korea, Canada, Argentina, Mars, known universe. Others that we've not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, line should be, well, gradually working down. Eventually it'll be everybody, but gradually working down. Others that we've not heard from at all, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Roz. Already mentioned you this evening. Did you hear yourself mentioned?
Yes, I did. Greetings right to on. You guys and to the other callers and listeners. Peace to you all. I think the clips were quite good, and I love the breakdown of the previous call. I greatly appreciate that because some of these things, as far as just the different ways white people practice racism, is something that I've been dealing with on my radio program as well recently. So it's great to actually have her elucidate those things for us to get a grasp on it, understand, because it's quite important. I caught the tail end when I started. It was on the tail end of the clip you played with Sasha Jenkins, and it sounded like is he doing a documentary on the Wu-Tang Clan and their history?
Yes, sir.
It's like the 25-year. Okay, cool. I thought that was interesting that you played that, because I'm not used to you really playing a lot of hip-hop oriented clips like that. But this one I found interesting just because of the impact that Wu-Tang Clan had, and the fact that the time that they came out, which would be considered what they call the golden age, and that was the time when I was actually in the music business myself as an artist and producer, and also working at a couple of labels as well. So the thing is that you can really look at all music, depending on the time frame it was made, it's all going to center around white supremacy as far as music, the development of music in the Western Hemisphere, as far as the United States is concerned. And the time that they came out, there was a lot more variety in the music you would hear, but all of it pertained to different areas of people activity in the system of white supremacy and how these artists were dealing with it, myself included at that time. So I think that's going to be interesting to look into. Megyn Kelly, I don't even want to speak on her. I think everybody else did quite great justice to her. But she's just a real savage racist in a dress. And that's the only way I'll describe her at this particular point. The clip you played on breast cancer and what Emmy had to say about that is quite interesting, because I actually dealt with colloidal silver and the fact that it helps to cure breast cancer. This was very recently that we did that, and it was actually a doctor who herself had breast cancer, stage 4 breast cancer, and she actually had a colleague suggest that she use colloidal silver as she was dealing with stage 4 breast cancer. She was using 10 parts per million, and she was able to successfully beat breast cancer, and she attributed it to silver because nothing else was working for her. Also, I just want to read a brief section of an article that I got from thesilveredge.com. I suggest everybody really put that site in your bookmarks. It has the most comprehensive and up-to-date scientific as well as direct accounts from people who've dealt with different illnesses, used colloidal silver, and conquered those illnesses, or at least got relief from those illnesses. So this is a brief article they have that says silver kills lung cancer cells and slows lung cancer tumor growth. In the past, I've written articles about clinical studies documenting the fact that silver kills or inhibits the growth of an astonishing array of cancers, including ovarian cancer, liver cancer, colon cancer, breast cancer, neuroblastoma cancer, cervical cancer, leukemia, i.e. blood cancer, and even cancers that are resistant to chemotherapy drugs. They also did a test and found that silver enhances the ability of cancer-fighting drugs to do their job. And when they tested the silver independent of the anti-cancer drug, that silver was even more effective than the anti-cancer drug itself. So this is stuff that I dealt with before. I just wanted to put that out there. Also, the fact that the vast majority of Black people in the Western Hemisphere are deficient in vitamin D. Vitamin D is one of the main components of the cancer fighting system in the human body. And because we're in the temperate area and we don't get as much access to sunlight, and also we have limited access because we're wearing clothes and because of the weather patterns here, we are more prone to more aggressive forms of any cancer, whether it's colon cancer. You'll find in Black people it's way more aggressive. Breast cancer is more aggressive for that reason. We have to supplement our diets with vitamin D. Also, CBD is known to kill tumors and shrink tumors directly. When it was tested in various studies, they actually put CBD directly on tumors and cancer cells and watched them kill the cancer cells right there in the petri dish. Also, I had a good friend that I met through my co-host, and she had lupus. She was given 6 months to live, and she was suffering with over 400 seizures a month. We gave her colloidal silver and also CBD, and through the use of those two things, she was able to actually go from over 400 seizures a month to less than 40. And then it got to the point where she showed no symptoms of even having lupus. And this was within the last year we've been dealing with her in this particular thing. So this is someone who I know personally and who I've just helped personally. So I just wanted to actually put that information out there just so that other people might be able to utilize that to their benefit. Also, another codified practice that I've developed that I think others, especially if you use computers at work and you might be using your phone to access their Wi-Fi system or whatever the case may be, is a portable VPN. I bought one for like $99. It's called the Butterfly VPN on Amazon. And basically it's one you can take with you that where you can utilize the Wi-Fi as long as you have access to the Wi-Fi. But it gives you a closed network that no one else will have access to except you. And it's something you can do to surf the web or do things you need to do and know that your company or anyone else will not have access to viewing or tampering with the sites that you're dealing with as far as seeing what you're doing, because it's a closed network that you'll be using within your company's closed network, let's say if you were accessing their Wi-Fi during the day. So I just wanted to put that out there as well. Also, I wanted to suggest, based on the previous caller, if you can look into having Dr. Edward Nichols. I don't know if you've dealt with him before, but he's a doctor who deals with white supremacy and the psychology. He's a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and I've heard him break down the different ways white people practice racism, especially on the job specifically, and I've never heard a person discuss the fact that in the way that he does, the fact that white people objectify us. And the way that he deals with them, and he describes it this way. He says, when I'm at work, I'm white. I function like a white person. And when I'm at home, I function like a black person. And basically, he does to them what they do to us. He objectifies them. And he gives specific examples of how he's able to do that without getting into any problems on the job, but also keeping their racism in check, because he doesn't seek any sort of gratification from them or any sort of validation from them. He just does the job, gets it done, and that's it. And it's just the way he takes that approach and the way he explains it, I think, is quite phenomenal and would be helpful for victims of racism to be able to access that, his ability to break that down as a psychiatrist or psychologist. And then lastly, I just wanted to say, recently I did a program dealing with confirmation bias and how it facilitates white supremacy. And a lot of the things that we suffer from as far as the experiences we have are really made from confirmation bias applied in different ways. So if, for example, either a police officer will see you do something that another white person would do and they would not pay attention to, but they will conjure up something criminal around that activity in order to attempt to harass you or arrest you. Or they'll automatically assume on sight, because you're black, you're already doing something criminal, and that gives them the impetus to stop you or stop and frisk you or whatever the case may be. Whereas, like someone previously spoke about with white people, they could be doing the most incredibly criminal things, and no one will pay them any attention simply because they have white skin. And that just has to do with the psychosocial conditioning of the system. And it works so successfully that you can take other non-white groups, indoctrinate them, let's say via the policing system, law enforcement, and you can make those people have the same confirmation biases against black people that they wouldn't have had if they didn't get the training and the psychological conditioning via the process of becoming a so-called police officer. So I just wanted to say that. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak. And with that, I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Roz. We'll see if we can get in contact. I'm trying to check out information on Dr. Nichols as we speak. Others that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. This is Henry from Chicago. Did I hear correctly that Cesar Sayoc, the pipe bomber, he has a non-white parent who is Filipino? Is that correct?
That's what they said in the report.
So is he classified as white or is he non-white?
I've heard reports where they classified him as white, but I also heard what you just heard in the report about the Filipino parent. So has anyone heard any reports where they've said that this is not a white person? Anybody heard any reports or anybody here that thinks that this is someone who is not classified as white? The alleged pipe bomber, the person that they arrested, anybody think that this is someone who is not white? Okay. Yeah, I thought I've seen several reports saying that he's a white person, but I did hear what you heard. Did you have more that you were going to share on that, sir?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I think we've discussed this before about, even in Mr. Fuller's work, the classification of white, you know, goes by what white people tell us. So I guess if he is not classified as, you know, non-white, then white people will let us know. So that was kind of weird there, but. Either way, you know, is, you know, like I said, white people will classify, you know, whoever they want to classify as white. Gregory Bush, the racist, the Kroger shooter, who basically wanted to shoot up, a black church, and the connection with, you know, with this pipe bombing. But I also wanted to make the strong connection, and I think earlier caller had brought this up about Dylann Roof, the racist who shot up the church in Charleston. You know, and the importance of that because of the fact that, and I remember Dr. Wilson was talking about how, you know, important that is, because now you have a copycat, you know, racist murderer out there who's trying to do the same thing, and he couldn't get into the church, so he decides to go and, you know, shoot some, you know, shoots black people in a store. But, you know, you look at that incident in 2015 of Dylann Roof and how calculated he was, you know, and then also leaving a manifesto where people can read it. So it's sort of like, you know, you got white supremacists out there who are basically planning on doing this, you know, again. And I'm pretty sure we're going to see this, you know, again. Somebody's going to attempt to, you know, shoot up a predominantly black church, and, you know, unfortunately, somebody's going to be successful. So, you know, that the importance of that Dylann Roof incident just, you know, just comes back to my mind when I think about the Gregory Bush incident. That's all for now. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, sir. Think copycat metaphor. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from at all, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Caller in Florida.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. The one segment where I know a few people spoke on the Flint, Michigan water situation and contamination, I did notice that too when the person who was doing the interviewing, he said that after the black child asked the question, I think it was about why did the water pipes burst in our area but not in any other area. So the parent, I guess the mother, she was responding, and then it transitioned into his voice saying that, well, her response was a very good fact base, almost like saying she was going to say something inaccurate, especially being a victim of racism. And I don't think they had enough clarification as to what her response was. And he did dismiss the dominant influence of racism and saying that, well, in Flint, Michigan, you have the water crisis is one problem, and then you have other things, or something to that effect. And also, I wanted to agree with the topic of emotions. For one, that metaphor where the guy was saying, I think it was a black male, he said that it felt like his manhood was, he was handing over his manhood. And I thought it was also another kind of sexual connotation to where they were talking about the stop and frisk situation as well. And they were talking about feelings, and someone described that it was, I guess, victims holding up their shirts, I guess, to the kind of signal that they didn't have any kind of a firearm or something on them. And it was just trying to, once again, just have it set focus on, well, the people just felt this way. It's not that they aren't being terrorized. They aren't reacting to terrorism and mistreatment. And one last thing I wanted to comment on was the governor debate and the codification. I think, in my opinion, the victim, Andrew Gillum, who's running for governor, he was very focused and he was very logical. And the suspected racist, Ron DeSantis, he became very emotional and he was very flagrant to the rules and regulations of the debate. And the moderator didn't seem to really reprimand him on that. He was allowing him to speak over the 45 or 30 or to 60 second time settings. And Mr. Gillen was pointing that out. He pointed it out like two times. So when the question came up about, we don't want to monkey this up in Florida, became very emotional one time where he was invited on at least four occasions to speak at some kind of an event where the moderator read off a quote saying something about a race war or something. And he was, and Ron DeSantis, he responded, well, he didn't really say that. He didn't say that. And then he didn't let the moderator finish his question. And he's like, well, how in the hell am I supposed to know? How in the hell am I supposed to know who says what? So I've never heard of anybody using that kind of language in a debate. Maybe it was, but I can only imagine if that was Mr. Gillum who became emotional like that, they would have definitely capitalized that on the media organizations. So Andrew Gillum, he pointed out that, Mr. DeSantis, he's definitely had these racist robocalls, and he's had a donor refer to the former president of the United States as a Muslim. He said N-I-G-G-E-R. Okay, so people pretty much understood what that was. So, yeah, he just became very emotional. He cut off Andrew Gillum, and he wasn't using logic, but he can afford not to because he's classified as white. And that's the only thing I have right now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, folks in Florida. If you can be attentive to what's happening with the gubernatorial race, as they call it, that would be appreciated. You probably learned a lot about the system of white supremacy, right? That sounds similar to when Barack Obama was running in 2008, just on a smaller, I think they would say a smaller scale, but since it's not presidential, it's on a local level, local, national, global, universal system of white supremacy. Others we've not heard from. Let's not lollygag. If you have a hand up, we have less than 30 minutes. So if you intend to speak, let's go ahead and hear from you now.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, everyone. Being that you just mentioned, and it was just talked about, the gubernatorial debate down here in Florida, another significant part of the debate that gives an excellent clinic on racist white supremacist code is when the white candidate was asked about whether or not the president is a good example for children. he didn't speak on the subject at all. He just went on a long dissertation on a totally different subject so smoothly that it indicates to any non-white person who would like to study how white people use racist codification. He did it so smoothly to where, as you noted, he probably was an expert on doing this since he was, I would say, before a teenager. To what I was going to express, it's also even more so, I think this week was a excellent clinic on racist codification and how white people practice racist codification. The Kroger incident, Kroger grocery store incident, was kind of overshadowed by the incident with the pipe bombs. Whereas the the white male actually was first going to attempt to kill a lot of non-white black people at a church. But anyway, I think that's why it didn't make as much of the news situation, and it's done on purpose. That's the reason why I brought it up, because it's done on purpose to place some other incident beyond a particular incident that you don't want to you don't want to emphasize. Although with the pipe bomb incident, no one was harmed at all. And I even questioned, although they did try to say that these devices were actually usable, I would question that on a lot of different ways and means, because just from the standpoint, none of them actually blew up in the transition of them going through the mail. As far as that concerned, with the incident that took place today, it wasn't the quote unquote Jewish incident that took place today, right? This morning.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes. That was a clinical example of white people who basically contend on racism, white supremacy against each other, actually on the most proficient ways, perhaps. And in turn, those type of things have been happening for a long time, where they actually act violently on each other. The pipe bomb incident, ironically, the post office where it was said that that kind of like broke the, I don't want to use a metaphor, that the law enforcement, stated that was, the first big clue, is only about 10 minutes from where I'm, sitting at right now. Only about 10 minutes away. Opa-locka itself can be used as my address, as far as that concerned. Based on the area, I was quite confident not exactly who it was, but what type of racial classification that person would be with the bombs. And yeah, that's just about everything I can think of right now. The area is surrounded by a small airport that I used to work at the fire station there. There is also, the whole area, is politically, the politicians in the area is just about all non-white black people. But nevertheless, white people control the area from the standpoint of owning all of the businesses and controlling the finances, therefore, in the area. But that's all to say. Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Others that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be
let's see, Draftomania.
How you doing, Jeff? Hello.
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Okay. I just wanted to say that congratulations to you on your prenatal certification, and I'm glad the show is back. I'm not going to be, I haven't been able to call in on work workplace racism because I have, I'm working a second shift now. I just started a temp assignment, and but I've been listening in. And I also wanted to just ask Ross what the name of his radio show is, and, you know, what station and all the information regarding his radio show, if possible, so I can support him also. And that's basically all I really had for this evening. And I thank you.
Much obliged, Draftomania. I will take one more caller, and then we'll see if Roz can hook us up with the information. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
May I be here?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, Steph, and greetings to all the callers on the line. The state of last week that that black people are Nike's number one consumer base, that's not true, and I blame white people for that misinformation because they're always telling lies about black people. We're not even their number two consumer base. Only 18% of Nike customers are black. 67% are white. Even that term consumer versus customer, I don't like that term consumer for black people because it's used to abuse black people. Like, white people are called customers, black people are called consumers. And this is not about me. I've never owned a pair of Jordans or LeBrons or Mellos or any of that. Never even paid over $100 for shoes. And I only have 3 pair of Nikes that I bought over decades ago. And I haven't bought any Nike anything since. I just don't think that black people should be criticized for nothing and be accused of doing incorrect things when they're not. I also wanted to correct something that I said yesterday on the book club. I said that someone said they had an argument with Pam about so-called interracial relationships. I wanted to let that be known that that wasn't just some gossip that I was spreading. That conversation can actually be seen on her website. And I don't know exactly where it is, but I would start in the interracial category on the website and go to the comments there, and it should be able to be seen down there. I also said that Mr. Demi Moore, when she and him got into a disagreement, I'll call it, that he shouted her down. I actually meant to say she shouted him down. In terms of how she conducted herself on the program when it came to talking about black men and black women, she did name call. She called Stephen A. Smith a puppet. I'm sorry, she called him a coon, actually. She was on the Things Anti-Racist Say broadcast, and you played a clip, Gus, of Stephen A. Smith saying some things, and she said that while she was on mute, she called him a coon and that she shouldn't have. She also used the word puppet a lot. And also on her website, from 2015, there's a statement from Mr. Fuller going back to using, I guess, certain terms like showcase blacks, for an example, to bring credibility to name calling. Mr. Fuller made a statement about black men should stop shucking, but he wasn't saying that to disparage black men, and he wasn't saying that they were like shucking and jiving and using it in that context. But she was using it to actually disparage black men. And when we played a clip, you hear that he's not talking. He was just talking about that black men should be real about that they should be honest about the fact that they can't protect anyone. And the person who called in yesterday, who was having, I guess, these issues and taking issues with some of our commentary, I think her name is Mimi, someone who I really appreciate her commentary, so I hope she continues to call in. And I'm not making these statements to disparage Pam at all. I'm just saying that as great as she was, that was one flaw that she had, that she didn't have objectivity when it came to black men and black women in terms of the way that she talked about them. And I think it was because she was in what I think I observed as admittedly in a tragic arrangement. I want to quickly say that black women are not most likely to die given childbirth, but the numbers, actually white women, they lead in that, and the numbers are close between white women and black women, but white women do lead in that. White women also lead in C-sections, and the numbers are not close with that. They also lead in obesity deaths. White people lead in obesity deaths. The number is not close to that. And those numbers are on Gus's Facebook page. The cancer thing is a lie as well, and the numbers are not close there as well. White people needing that, and I'll put that on Gus's Facebook page as soon as I can. I'm almost done. And also, this term about most likely, white people use that term to be very deceptive. I think instead of saying most likely, I think the best term to use is most, meaning who dies most in childbirth or who has C-section most or things like that. If you use those terms and you look at the numbers in those terms, you'll find out the truth. I think that the NAACP is powerful, and they are a white organization. They were founded by white people. And what they tend to do is that they, when black people actually try to genuinely fight against racism, they stop that, and they have people who work, black people who work for them, who try to talk honestly about racism, and they put a stop to that as well. And I just wanted to quickly ask Gus, do you know any idea of when you will be going home? Because I know that you're still a flood victim. I mean, I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Oh, I can answer that one quickly. Nope. We have lots of folks that apparently still have not commented. I will still nab Roz for our promo before we conclude. I will try to get as many folks as I can while we have the time. Folks, we've missed completely. Any callers that we've missed, maybe I'm confused. Any callers that we've missed completely? Anyone that has a hand up that we've not heard from at all?
Can I be heard?
Greetings in Mondesi.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listener. I was going to make mention about the happening in Louisville, Kentucky, the white male who shot a number of people in Kroger's and ended up killing two black people. The reports were conflicting initially, well, even still, a lot of misinformation. We were told first that seven people were shot. And even some of the information, whether it was misinformation or omitting information, it was important, but there was information that was misinformation, two different conflicting or more conflicting stories from the media. So first we weren't told the racial classification of the shooter or any of the victims. And the way I found out was on Facebook, because I'm friends with a good portion of the black people in the city. Or Facebook friends, whatever.
I'm so sorry. For interrupting. I'm so sorry. I just wanted to ask for context. Are you in that part of the world, Kentucky? If you don't want to share, that's fine too. But just, I thought that was relevant. Are you in that part of the world?
I am.
Okay.
I think by now, you know, it's okay for me to say. So yes, sir, I am. So I'm here, and you know, the people I'm seeing, people who are affected. I'm talking to people who are affected. It's so close to the election. It's just within 2 weeks of the election that I say that absolutely this is a political plant assassination. The person who was assassinated was not any random person. It wasn't just a, how do you say? There's not powerful blacks, but there's still notable blacks. So, you know, he was known. Even he was the father of one of the workers in the mayor's office, if I have that correct. It wasn't a random happening. And then even I think he had accomplice. I could be incorrect, but I think the white male who approached him, maybe not. Let me not. It's just suspicious. The white male who approached the active shooter, who was also a white male, he did not shoot. But he knew that there was an active shooter situation. He knew that this was the shooter, and he approached him with his gun drawn, according to reports. He did not shoot. The white shooter said whites don't kill whites, according to one male that is reported to be his son, but that's suspicious. The son guy, did a report and they recorded the son, supposed son, speaking. He wears sunglasses, so you can't see his eyes to tell whether he's telling the truth or not. He seems unbothered by anything that happened, but he can say that he's unbothered because he said that he didn't see anything. He only came after the situation and spoke with his father, and now he's reporting back what the father said. So we don't get to hear the father firsthand. We hear this random guy called the son with sunglasses who wasn't at the scene of the crime. And if you just listen to him, it just all seems scripted. The FBI, the ATF, the this and the that, all these other white groups are here in Louisville about black people. So earlier, there was a lot of things in the news. Louisville made it in the news because the white media intentionally misdirected everybody, saying that 2,000 black teenagers were rioting in the mall, but there wasn't 2,000 black teenagers in the mall, and none of them were rioting. There was very few teenagers. It was later rescinded, but after it went to CNN, and then that's when then there was another big news story where they said that so many hundred black teenagers were rioting by the river. And then so they're going to bring in all these different groups, organized groups of white military people, or however you want to call them, and they're going to put a correction to all these black teenagers. So now they're here in the city, and now they're looking into this case where this white male killed these black people. So it wasn't discussed that it wasn't discussed that it was black people that were killed. But I'm suspicious, with the FBI being in this part of the world and all this stuff happening, I'm suspicious as to whether they're involved. But anyway. It's just very interesting. It even makes me frightened. We don't shop in I shop in my neighborhood, but because they don't give us real food, they don't, and all our produce and our meat is bad, you know, when I do eat meat, whatever, but I have to go to the east end of the city to go find my food. And then Jeffersonville is the first area that you get to. Jeffersontown, excuse me, is the first area that you get to, basically going east. You can go about that far east and you get some good food. And you go a little bit further east, you can get some, you know, real good food, whole food stuff. Anyway, it could have been me, it could have been my mother, it could have been any of my people, you know. And these they're following me in helicopters. They're using small airplane crafts, flying low in my vicinity where I can see them and they can see me. They're shining lights on me through their helicopter with their helicopters, following me blocks. I swear to you, following me from I'm not going to tell you the streets, following me for a good 20 blocks. I walk distances and this is, and they track me, and it's frightening. But, you know, sometimes I feel like I don't know what's the most safe thing for me to do. Am I supposed to leave the country? You know, I can't change my last name. They know who I am. My family was in politics, so, you know, that's that. So, I mean, I can't hide, you know. So I don't know exactly what I need to do. But yeah, they're out here. White people are repping. How do you know? Let me not say that. They're doing things that are frightening me. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing. Difficult circumstances, certainly. Global war of racism, white supremacy, but acute things happening in your area. I know it's one of those things where it can be difficult because there really isn't anywhere to hide. That's why I keep saying global system. It's not like there is anywhere that you can go to escape. I guess as best you can, care for your mental health as best you can under very difficult circumstances. Try as best you can to stay out of harm's way and Wow, given everything that's happened there. I mean, just to emphasize again what you said, being right there that, you know, hey, any of your friends, relatives, people that you care about could have been at the store that day or the church that he was talking about or any other facility. It just happened that he stopped at the Kroger, that he could have stopped anywhere in that, you know, area. Just talking about that is the real danger that we're talking about and why there should be an urgency to solving this problem. Did we miss anybody? Anybody have a hand up that we have not heard from at all? Lollygag too long. Roz, did you want to give folks the info for the broadcast, your broadcast, sir?
Oh, thank you very much, Gus, and thanks to the caller who had asked for that information. Yes, the name of the show is Real Life. And we're actually on Black Talk Radio Network as well on our own radio station called Foundational Radio. And we come on Tuesday nights from 9 to 11. And the call-in number is area code 704-802-5056. And you would press star if you wish to ask a question or make a comment on the program. And also, I thank you for letting me provide that and giving me the opportunity. And I also just wanted to say specifically the type of vitamin D that we are lacking in is vitamin D3. That's D in the number 3. That's the one that we really need. That's the one that the body produces when our skin is in contact with the sun. So that is what we are basically almost all of us, if not all of us, are deficient in. And that is one of the main ingredients that the body uses to actually stop cancer from even starting in the body. That's like one of the main immune boosters that the body depends on. So without it, you're leaving yourself compromised. Thank you very much, Gus, for the opportunity. I'll mute myself.
Much obliged, Roz, for the information, and all the folks who dialed in. Thanks to Ivy for the information. Definitely encourage anyone, check out statistics, really any info, but any statistics, especially if they're tending to sound like, oh man, Black people are messed up again. I will review the CDC statistics for the C-section and death rates and get back to you. I saw I posted on my Facebook page, but it has been a long weekend. But yes, much obliged. And again, everyone should be advised, be dubious and, you know, double check information. There are lies. And sometimes people do make errors. That happens as well. But there are lots of intentional, deliberate lies in the system of racism, white supremacy. That said, we will be here. So we're rotating. Book Club Thursday, Dr. Tommy Curry, The Man Knot. Neutralizing Workplace Racism Fridays. Slight switch. I didn't hear any objections when we raised this, so shouldn't be any gripes now. We will be back regular schedule. You can check the Black Talk Radio Network page, Facebook for updates for upcoming broadcasts. I'm going to try and see if we can get Dr. Marvin Dunn on the program. He was with us before to talk about what's happening down in Florida. His book, The Beast in Florida. Fantastic information. If you are a Florida resident, that should be mandatory part of your library. You can go back in the archives, I think 2013, if my memory is working today, to hear Dr. Dunn on the program. But I'm going to see if we can get him back to talk about so much happening in the great state of Florida, sunshine and all. But check back with us to get the updates, and we will have future counter-racist broadcasts. That's it. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Man, imagine being at the Kroger and you're not thinking correctly. You've been drinking whatever, smoking whatever, and you're at the Kroger parking lot and this happens. That's why Dr. Welsing, many others, Gus T, emphasize regularly, system of white terrorism. We really want to make sure that we are thinking correctly so that whites being white, that happens. We can do whatever we need to do to get out of harm's way. These type of things happen regularly in the system of white supremacy. And when I say these type of things, I mean exactly what happened at Kroger, the synagogue today. Take your pick. In addition to being sober, each and every time we're in a vehicle, let's make sure that we are buckled up, driver or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other white people. Excuse me. Whew. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.